Okay, if we can begin, we'll pick up where we left off. So we're going to education, and we'll try the same routine. We'll have folks up at the table, the House and Senate staff, and whoever gets up there first gets to start introducing themselves. So do we have everybody ready to go? So, and we'll just ask, we'll start with Mr. Aronson or Mr. Strom, whoever, whichever side wants to go first. Just to
Chair, Bjorn Aronson, Senate Nonpartisan Research.
Mr. Chair, Jay Wilms, Senate Fiscal Staff.
Mr. Chair, Melissa Johnson, House Fiscal.
Mr. Chair, I'm Tim Strom from House Research.
Great. And however you were going to, whoever's going to start presenting the spreadsheet, Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members,
thank you for coming.
We are going. Mr. Wilms and I will be walking you through two spreadsheets. One is the appropriations tracking sheet, and that tracks the state aid portions of education funding. And then we also have a property tax levy tracking spreadsheet that we'll also be going through. And we're going to work through the spreadsheet together and talk about the similarities and differences. So, getting started.
Johnson, can I just ask a favor?
Sure.
We're remodeling the Capitol, so we don't have quite the sound system you have in the House. So.
More?
Yeah, if you could just pull that a little bit closer.
Yeah, it should be on.
With the Senate room, so.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, a key component of the House's proposal is a 1% increase on the formula allowance. This equates to about a $58 per pupil funding increase for the basic formula amount. This equates to about $54.4 million for fiscal 15, and following to fiscal 16 and 17, about a $61 million cost. Another provision that both the House and the Senate are interested in is the ELL, or English Language Learners, programming to be allowed to go till 6 years. Currently, it's at 5 years, and both have interest in expanding to 6 years. The House also has a position or has a proposal to have two other components, and the first one is to allow students that have passed the access test. It's a test that students in this area would take for proficiency. If they pass the test, but they haven't yet met the full time period, if the teacher recommends that the student would be well served by having that additional services, that they would be able to continue. And the final piece would be a funding formula increase for ELL from $704 to $726 per pupil.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the Senate's number you'll notice is lower. This is because the Senate's position only tracks the change from 5 to 6 years and doesn't track the other changes.
Mr. Chair and members, line 13 is PSEO formula correction. I won't get into the details of this. This is related to a pupil weighting change that was put into effect last session, and this was also brought forward by the governor. And so by implementing this, it would be a $2.7 million savings annually.
16, go ahead. Mr. Chair and committee members, on line 14, you'll see equity changes, metro definition. The House and Senate carry two similar provisions.
Are they changing them?
On the Senate's position, under current law, a district is classified as part of the metro region based on the location of their administrative headquarters, and districts that are classified as metro receive a 25% increase in their equity funding. Under the proposed law, a district would be considered a metro region if any portion of its boundaries overlap the seven-county metro area.
And Mr. Chair and members, the House has a slightly different take on the equity provision, and the House position is that beginning in fiscal 17, that districts that are within the broader 13 county metropolitan statistical area would be, that have administrative offices within that area, would be newly eligible for equity aid as well, as in terms of their definition as being from the metro area.
Additionally, the Senate's provision is effective fiscal 15, and the House is effective fiscal 17.
On line 16, 17, and 44, all three of these items for the non-public pupil revenue, non-public pupil transportation, and tribal contract schools, each of these program formulas is tied to increases in the general education formula, and so to the extent that the House is proposing a 1% increase, these areas would be increased as well. On line 49, the House proposes for fiscal 15 only in an increase for the concurrent enrollment. Concurrent enrollment is a program whereby high school students can earn dual credit for high school and college level coursework, and that would be a one-time provision.
Mr. Chair and committee members, if we could go back to line 24 through 27, to the Senate has some provisions. On line 24, operating capital formula, the Senate's position is to enhance the equalization to offset levy increases effective for fiscal 16 and 17. As you'll notice in fiscal year 16 of the Senate's position, that enhanced equalization is $4 million. In fiscal 17, it's $3.3 million. Line 25, the Senate has a Hendricks reciprocity exemption. Hendricks and Ivanhoe school districts were cooperating, and Ivanhoe had a reciprocity exemption, and when the districts parted in their collaboration, Hendricks no longer had that reciprocity exemption, and so the Senate provides them with that. Line 26, that captures the Crosswinds to Perpich transition. It grants control of the Crosswind School to the Perpich Center and generates a small decline in general education revenue. And this provision is carried by the House and the Senate. Line 27, that's the PSEO remedial credit for ALCs. It allows a student who qualifies for a graduation incentives program and enrolls full-time in a dual credit middle or early college program to take remedial classes, and so it generates extra funding under the PSEO provision.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd also like to highlight in the general ed area on line 15, the consolidation transition revenue. This is a provision where that it would expand eligibility for districts that are in the process of consolidating with a neighboring district or districts. Currently, the districts are able to receive $200 per pupil in the first year for all of the students within the joining districts, and $100 per pupil in the second year. This provision would provide $300 per pupil and it would allow them to be eligible for up to 5 years. Also, it expands the allowable use of the funds of the transition revenue to include building debt. On line 52, the House has and the Senate have a provision for increased funding for the Minnesota Reading Corps. The House position is $500,000 per year.
The Senate's position is $2 million one time in fiscal 15.
On the next page, on line 64, the House proposes $500,000 starting in fiscal 15 for recovery program grants. This would be funding for programs that work with students that are recovering from substance abuse and would provide additional different supports for like dependency counselors, psychologists, and nurses. So that's ongoing. There's no Senate provision.
Mr. Chair and committee members, line 65, that teacher evaluation, that's money distributed to school districts and charters and intermediates to implement the teacher evaluation requirements for fiscal year 15. This is one-time money. It's fiscal year 15, it's $15 million, and then in fiscal year 16, it's $1 million because the money is
$9 million.
I'm sorry, fiscal year 15, it's $9 million, and then in fiscal 16, $1 million. Line 66, that would be IT certifications. $340,000 in fiscal year 15 only is appropriated to provide IT education opportunities for high school students statewide. And then line 67 provides $160,000 in fiscal year 15 only to Northwestern Online College and the high school programs.
Leroy.
line 73, special education fiscal year 14 and on. You'll notice in the Senate's position in fiscal year 17, there's a small savings of $150,000. This relates to a levy increase of $600,000 in fiscal 16 and 17 ongoing regarding a satellite transportation hub. Built by Rosemont, Apple Valley, Eagan. Since it will generate state aid appropriation savings, this is captured in fiscal 17.
Mr. Chair and members, the House also adopts the position that Mr. Welms just mentioned, but also includes funding beginning in fiscal 16, for the biennium $447,000. For one-to-one supports at the Minnesota State Academies for the Deaf and Blind. This was a provision that the governor brought forward and that the House carries in our language. On line 85, debt service equalization aid. This is the only a House position, and this has to do similarly to our counterparts equalizing or enhancing the equalization aid so as to bring the levy target down to zero. On line 86, debt service equalization aid for disasters. There are a couple of districts in that have been impacted by natural disasters, and there has been a proposal to significantly increase the equalization that these districts would be eligible so that it would be easier for their voters to support. And so if the equalization is provided at this point, it would be about $2 million starting in 2017, and also if the voters of the district approve the bond issue, then that would be a cost that would be ongoing. And both the House and the Senate have that provision.
Moving on to line 96, school lunch and food storage. This is a governor's proposal. The bill, the position prohibits districts from charging students for lunch if they're eligible for reduced price lunch. Additionally, it increases the state reimbursement amount provided to students eligible for for reduced price lunches. The current reimbursement is 12.5 cents, and this position increases that to 52.5 cents. Moving on to line 98, breakfast for kindergarten. Similarly, this prohibits the charging of fees for breakfast to kindergarten students and raises the reimbursement rate to school districts.
I'd like to refer to one more item on this page, line 88, telecommunication access. This is a House position beginning in fiscal 15. There would be an increase of telecommunications access aid of $5 million per year, and this would be ongoing.
Mr. Chair? Thank you. Question. With regard to the House number, is different from the Senate number, so could you just let me know for the breakfast school lunch program, what went into your calculation?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonoff, could you point to the
now
line?
Now I see. I'm sorry. I was looking at the wrong columns. They are the same. Very good. Thank you.
I should clarify that the breakfast position is only carried by the Senate.
Right. I was looking at the wrong line.
Yeah.
Kindergarten. Breakfast.
Line 122, early childhood family education. This is a Senate-only position. There are two changes here to document. The first is an increase in spending of $8.9 million in fiscal year 15, and then additionally $19.5 million in the TALES. The other important provision to note is that it links the funding formula to the basic formula, indexes it to future increases. Line 123, school readiness. It increases school readiness. The Senate's position increases school readiness funding by $3.4 million in fiscal 15 and $7.5 million in the TALES.
Mr. Chair and members, on line 124, we have health and developmental screening aid. The House is proposing $250,000 per year beginning in FY15 and going forward for additional funds for developmental screening for 3- and 4-year-olds.
Line 125, the vision therapy pilot project. It provides a one-time appropriation of $500,000 in fiscal year 15. The language establishes a 3-year grant program to fund vision therapy pilot projects in up to 2 school districts. Moving on to line 130, this is a Senate-only position. It increases scholarship funding, ongoing funding by $6.7 million each year, and then provides $2.15 million of one-time funding in fiscal year 15. Additionally, it removes the scholarship cap of $5,000 and allows the commissioner to establish a target for the average scholarship amount per child based on the results of a rate survey. Line 131, parent-child home program. This provides $100,000 in fiscal year 15 only to the parent-child home program.
Mr. Chair and members, line 144, adult basic education. Both the House and the Senate propose a return to the 3% growth factor for the program funding, and that at a cost of $213,000 in FY15. Also, line 146 and 147 are the Northside Achievement Zone and the St. Paul Promise neighborhoods. The House proposes $1.132 million in a grant to these organizations for FY15 and builds them into the base for the future biennium.
The Senate's position is a one-time appropriation of $600,000 to each organization in fiscal 15.
Mr. Chair and members, on the on line 163, the Department of Education base budget, there's two pieces that are included in here. One piece is an ongoing that was built into the base is $85,000 to the department for language that we'll be discussing on maltreatment reporting requirements, and so that the $85,000 would be ongoing. There is also a $40,000 one-time appropriation for special ed rulemaking that would be for FY15 only. So the 40 plus the 85 is the 125 you see for the biennial total, and then the 170 is the $85,000 for the maltreatment going forward for the biennium. The next line, 165, the Board of School Administrators, the House only proposes an operating increase of $58,000 per year for the Board of School Administrators. The Board of Teaching on the next line, the House proposes for a one-time only in 2015 funds to help support the Board of Teaching for the Minnesota Teacher Licensure Exam. Work that they're doing on that. Line 169, both the House and the Senate have one-time funding in FY15 for the Works Museum, which is in Bloomington. Line 147, restrictive procedures, that this is a one-time proposal that the House has for FY15 to provide assistance to school districts that have a high incidence of use of prone restraint. Line 175 on the next page is the inventory for career and technical programs. And this is a one-time appropriation of $150,000 for the department to do a comprehensive statewide analysis of the programming for career and tech programs in our schools. Line 176, Headwater Science Center, both the House and the Senate propose a one-time $50,000 grant to the Headwater Science Center. And on 177, one-time appropriation the House is proposing for QCOMP teacher evaluation alignment. Line
178 is a Senate-only provision. It's $73,000 in fiscal year 15 only, appropriated to the Department of Education to conduct a report that surveys the current status quo or the state of physical education programming in the state.
It could be the Dayton School.
Under the Minnesota State Academies, you'll see there's a base adjustment proposed by both the House and the Senate. This was also brought forward by the governor's office. This would provide, again, what I was speaking to in the special ed area, additional one-to-one supports for students that have those needs, and that is carried forward into the next biennium as well. And under the Minnesota Management and Budget, there's one-time funding of $294,000 for the health insurance transparency bill. That bill is traveling, as I understand, separately, but is carried in this bill. So on line 219, you'll see what the totals proposed spending increases over base for each of the bodies.
Do
members have any questions? Otherwise, we can move to the levy tracking.
Okay. Questions on the general fund appropriations? Okay.
So the Mr. Chair and committee members, the spreadsheet is titled Education Finance Levies. We'll start on line 9. Line 9 captures the levy impact of the equity changes relating to the redefinition of the metro region that was discussed earlier because it also has an appropriations impact. As you'll notice, the Senate's provision is effective sooner than the House's version. Line 10 is the operating capital offset. This is for the Senate's position due to the levy increases to have net zero impact. Operating capital is enhanced in fiscal year 16 and fiscal year 17. So those are line 9 and 10. Line 33, we move to the safe schools increase. This provides a safe schools, the Senate provides a safe schools, an increase to the safe schools formula of $5 per pupil in fiscal year 16 and ongoing.
Mr. Chair and members, the House also has a funding for the safe schools levy for intermediates, but does not begin until pay 16 fiscal 17.
Moving ahead to line 58, in fiscal year 6, this change is actually effective in fiscal year 16, fiscal year 15. There's a $50 increase bringing districts, allowing them to lease levy per pupil to 212. It also provides a $19 increase to $65 for intermediate districts. This is effective in fiscal year 15 and ongoing, and you'll see below, we'll discuss there will be a prior year adjustment, a double levy in fiscal year 16 to allow districts to take it, to use that money. Line 59 is the satellite transportation hub. This is, the Rosemont-Apple Valley-Eagan School District. This is the levy increase that generates the special education savings, as discussed earlier. And we'll go to line 68. The equity changes, metro equity redefinition, is effective fiscal year 15. So we track a double levy increase in fiscal year 16 of $900,000. Additionally, on line 74, because the building lease adjustment is effective fiscal year 15, we'll track additional levy increase in fiscal year 16.
Mr. Chair and members, on the next page on line 103, debt service levy. This is a provision both the House and the Senate have agreed to adopt to. It is the levy component of the portion I spoke to before related to disaster impact or disaster equalization aid. And this is a $2.8 million levy that would anticipate to begin in FY17. So it does need voter approval, so this is pending voter approval. And just to mention, the two districts that are contemplated that would be eligible for this are Moose Lake and Rushford Peterson. And finally, on line 104, debt equalization. Again, this is the House's approach to providing increased enhanced equalization in order to get the levy target to zero for the House's spending in the levy area.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay. Questions on the levies?
Mr. Chairman, I...
Representative Carlson.
If we could go back to the safe school levy, I was curious about the delay for the intermediates.
Mr. Chair, members, that was just a decision that the House made to lessen the impact for the future biennium.
So it was to fit
it will still be in place, but
with
it will
the levy
not be
target,
good.
Is that what was driving that? Maybe I should ask. I'm asking about a House position, but I'm just kind of curious. I happen to live in an area where we're served by the intermediates, mm-hmm. And that's why I was asking it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the main part was it wouldn't be a levy for this year, but for the next payable year, 15. So, and I don't know, does the Senate have it for this, for 14? Yeah, I think this takes impact and would be fiscal year 15, payable year 15 would be the, I think is when that levy takes impact.
We can talk about that, Mr. Chairman, later. It was a House position. It was just one that I just happened to pick up on now as to why the delay. But
good
we
point.
Can find that out later. Thank you.
Okay, other questions on the levy appropriations? If not, who wanted to start with language? I'm not sure in terms of Article 16 is, I think, where we're beginning. So, Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Aronson will start.
Okay.
Mr. Chair and members, so I think how Mr. Strom and I will do this is I'll begin, and as soon as I encounter a section that doesn't have a corresponding section in the House or the House is different, then I'll kick it across the table. But beginning with Article, page R1, A16, reserve revenue, the House and Senate have similar positions. The significant, or the operable difference is that in the Senate position, the reserve revenue would exclude the local optional revenue. Midway down the page, Section 2, House side, Section 15, Senate side, this is the same provision. It's a technical change related to the elimination of the property tax recognition shift. Page R2, enrollment priority. Again, this is the same on both bodies. It allows a student eligible to participate in the graduation incentives program that enrolls full-time in a middle or early college program to receive developmental college credits effective July 1, 2014. The next section is actually the same. It's the sort of technical correction related to the pupil waiting on post-secondary enrollment options, and it generates the savings that Mr. Williams and Ms. Johnson previously identified. Section, now we're page R3, Section 5 on the House side, Section 19 on the Senate side. The definition of Gen Ed revenue for charter schools, it clarifies that a charter school does not receive local optional or location equity revenue, and that a charter school should receive the declining enrollment revenue as if it were a school district, rather than the state average declining enrollment revenue. English learner, beginning at the bottom of page R3, this is the same in both bodies, except that the House has an additional comma at page 148, line 31. It again allows a pupil to generate English learner aid for up to 6 years of enrollment in Minnesota schools and makes some allowances for the judgment of the pupil's classroom teacher with regard to their ability to successfully and fully participate in core curriculum with academic language proficiency in English.
Mr. Chair, members, at the bottom of page R4, section 7, this increases the English language learner funding formula, the basic formula, from $704 to $726 per pupil beginning in fiscal year 15. Section 8 on the House side creates a new source of funding for recovery programs. The funding level is set in, as the appropriations folks talked about, at $500,000. In subdivision 2 on page R5, you can see that the funding goes out as grants in amounts not to exceed $125,000 per program. Section 9 in the House and Senate bills deals with a clarification to the learning year program. Again, the Senate language picks up the change in local optional revenue that should be included on both sides. At the bottom of page R6, in the top of page R7 is the formula allowance increase. The House bill increases the formula allowance beginning in fiscal year 15 by 1 percentage point, and that carries on into the future. Section 11 is in both the House and Senate bill of the same as a technical correction related to last year's bill.
Continuing in the middle of page R7, on the Senate side, Section 54, operating capital levy. These the new language here at line 10 and 11 relate to increasing the strength of the operating capital equalization to offset levy increases elsewhere in the Senate bill as a whole, such that the whole bill is levy neutral. Beginning at the bottom of page R7 and continuing on to R8, this is equity revenue. It makes some technical adjustments to the pupil unit classification related to the pupil weighting changes from actually not the weighting changes, but other pupil unit changes from last year's bill. And here, here's where the House makes the sort of additional regional definition for metro equity. It more or less corresponds to the new language on the Senate side at the bottom of page R8. It's just in a different place in law, but the effect is analogous. At the top of page R9, again, regional equity gap. This is another technical correction related to the pupil unit definition. District equity gap, same thing. Transition revenue. The new language is at the top third of page R10. This ensures that as alternative teacher compensation revenue or QComp revenue was rolled outside of general education in last year's bill, that that rollout is properly accounted for in calculating a district's transition revenue inside general education into the future. Section 16 on the House side and Section 60 on the Senate side simply strikes obsolete language. Continuing on to the top of page R11, referendum aid guarantee. This is a technical correction related to the location equity or local optional revenue that was enacted last session. It provides that without this new language, the law would sort of over-guarantee referendum aid to a district. So this ensures that the referendum equalization aid is summed with the location equity aid for the purposes of guaranteeing aid into the future. Continuing on, middle of page R11, section 18 on the House side, section 62 on the Senate side, referendum revenue. The new language is actually all the way down at page R13, and it's purely technical related to ensuring that the ballot language states the amount of revenue requested per adjusted pupil unit to correspond with the way the referendum revenue is actually calculated. Board-approved referendum allowance in the middle of page R13. This is a technical correction to clarify this order of operations and the interaction between the board-approved referendum allowance and the local optional revenue subtraction that passed into law last session. Safe schools levy, continuing on to page R14, the changed language is at the top of page R15, and as Mr. Williams and Ms. Johnson indicated, it is here that the $5 per pupil is added to the authority for intermediate districts, or for districts that are members of intermediate school districts. Section 21 on the House side, section 67 on the Senate side. Pardon me. It's the same language here, and it's basically a conforming change, recognizing the elimination of the aid payment shift.
Mr. Chair, members, starting on the bottom of page R15, section 22 on the House side has to do with the payment, cleanup payment for charter schools. The new language can be found on page R18. And essentially what happens here is the cleanup payment for charter schools would go back to conforming to that of school districts now that the property now that the aid payment shift has been restored to the 90-10 split. Prior to this change, essentially the charter schools had a different payment schedule for the early payment of the 10% cleanup payment. Starting on the bottom of page R18, clarification related to special education and alternative attendance programs. Then, Mr. Chair, members, starting on page R20, Section 24 amends a session law from 2012 that established the innovative delivery of education services program. The House adds some language regarding how those pilots can last and essentially changes the rolling schedule of them a bit. That language is then continues on the next page as well. Then starting on the top of page R22 the effective date for that same provision. And this essentially clarifies the effective date so that a grant pilot project that starts after 2014 could still last for the full 5 years. Mr. Chairman, members, then start the appropriations, which the fiscal analysts have covered. We'll perhaps only highlight those that are separate or with language or riders in them. Otherwise, we've talked about them as part of the appropriations overview.
Mr. Chair, members, then continuing on to the middle of page R22, Section 92, the reciprocity agreement exemption for Hendricks School District. This is described by Mr. Wilms. It basically exempts the Hendricks School District from the reciprocal agreement that the state has with South Dakota.
And, Mr. Chair, finally, the appropriation we spoke of for the approved recovery programs for the school districts that are dealing with students who have recovery needs is $500,000. That's on the bottom of page R22. And finally, Mr. Chair, the end of this article on page R23 is a reviser instruction to clarify the name of the location equity revenue, which was changed to local optional revenue in a bill that passed earlier this session. With that, Mr. Chair, that's a quick summary of Article 16.
Okay. Any questions on that article? Do you want to continue to 17?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Larson will be joining us on the House side for that article.
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chairman, members, beginning in Article 17, Sections 1 and 2 in the House are exactly the same as an amendment that the Senate adopted on the Senate floor yesterday for the Senate Education Policy Committee.
And Ms. Larson, I'm going to ask you if you could just maybe pull the mic a little bit closer, if that's okay.
This particular provision was authored in the House by Representative Faust, and it has to do with transmitting information about a teacher discharge, either due to the conviction for child abuse or neglect, or when a final determination of maltreatment is made. This information is intended to be included in the teacher's employment record and to be given to both the Board of Teaching and the Education Department with information that would be relevant to the individual's license. State licensing data law applies. School boards and other hiring entities are directed to contact the board and the department to determine what action has been taken against the teacher's license, and there's also a requirement that hiring authorities disseminate this information to other school districts seeking to hire the individual as long as the transmission of the data is consistent with state and federal law and applicable collective bargaining agreements.
Mr. Chair, members, as Ms. Larson indicated, the language here in this bill you'll obviously see is substantially different, though the education policy bill language is the same.
Questions from the committee? Okay, Mr. Arneson?
Mr. Chair, members, we'll continue on page R3. For the heading Development, Evaluation, and Peer Coaching for Continuing Contract Teachers. This, the stricken language and the new language seeks to align the TD&E statutes more closely with some of the provisions of QCOMP. It's relatively straightforward, the new language here. See also the next section on page R5. It's duplicated because there are basically two sections of law relating to different sets of school districts.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, members, those two sections that Mr. Arneson referenced pertain to teachers generally and teachers in first-class city school districts. The House has the very same language in the education policy bill. And, Mr. Chairman, we previously discussed the substance of Section 2, which is the same arrangement addressing both teachers generally and teachers in first-class city school districts.
Mr. Chair, continuing then on to page R8, Section 4 on the Senate side, alternative teacher professional pay system. This, again, from the other side of the coin, seeks to align the alt-comp professional pay system with the teacher development and evaluation law. And note the effective date there is paragraph B, clause 3, is effective for agreements under this section approved after August 1st, 2015, so that it's not retroactive to agreements that are already executed.
And, Mr. Chairman, members, again, that same provision is in the House Education Policy Bill, House File 2397, third engrossment.
Mr. Chair and members, now we're on to the middle of page R9, Section 3 on the House side, Section 5 on the Senate side. These provisions are the same. It clarifies a cross-reference to the Alternative Teacher Compensation or QCOMP program. Continuing on to page R10, federal, state, and local requirements. The new language is actually at the bottom of page R11. It's a technical change relating to series of clauses that was augmented earlier in this article.
Mr. Chairman, members, the change in the clause refers back to the alignment of QCOMP and teacher evaluation, and the House Education Policy Bill would have had the same change except for a technical mistake.
Mr. Chair and members, now we're on to page R12. Sections 4 on the House side and 40 on the Senate side. These are identical provisions relating to the calculation of achievement and integration revenue. This is a provision coming from MDE school finance in the governor's bill. Similarly, the next section, incentive revenue, relating to achievement and integration revenue. It brings us to page R13, powers and duties, meaning powers and duties and the report of the P20 partnership. The new language there at lines 6 and 7 require the partnership in their regularly scheduled report to consider realigning the governance administrative structures of various education systems in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, members, in the House bill, although the language that appears in Clause 4 on the Senate side is not in the House, in its education policy bill, has specific language for how for proposing to realign the governance and administrative structures of K-12 and post-secondary systems in the context of career and technical education.
Mr. Chair, members, on page R14, Section 6 on the House side is the increase in the concurrent enrollment program funding that was talked about by the fiscal analysts. Section 7 is the, and correspondingly Section 77 on the House side, is the increase in the Serve Minnesota funds for the Reading Core program, again talked about earlier. Then, Mr. Chair, if you'll move to page R15.
Mr. Yeah. Chairman, members, in contrast to what the Senate has in the finance bill, the House is proposing to direct the Education Commissioner to consult with experts and legislators on how to better align the teacher evaluation, the development and evaluation system, and QCOMP, and to report to the legislature by February 1, 2015, on affecting and funding that improved alignment. So that was essentially the House alternative to the language that's in the finance bill, but And Mr. Chairman, members, Section 9, for which there is no comparable provision in the Senate, directs the Education Commissioner to consult with experts about secondary and post-secondary career and technical education programs, to examine the progression of coordinated, non-duplicative courses that students would need to successfully complete a technical education program, and to report to the legislature by February 1, 2015. This report would include information about school districts' dedicated equipment, resources, and relationships with post-secondary institutions and local business community members in affecting career and technical education programs.
Mr. Chair and members, now we're on the bottom of page R16, Section 89, the Senate side. Info technology certification partnerships. It authorizes the commissioner to contract with a provider to provide these education opportunities and requires that the partnership allow students to secure technology certifications. These services would be sort of geographically distributed in regional development commission areas around the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, members, although there is not the same language in the Senate, in the House Education Policy Bill, that House bill does have language proposing to establish innovative technology agreements.
Mr. Chair and members, page R17, Section 91. On the Senate side, legislative report on K-12 students' experience with physical education. This was described earlier when in the spreadsheet walkthrough. It directs the commissioner to prepare a report and submit it to the legislature by January 15th of next year and specifies the dimensions of physical education in Minnesota that the report should examine. Continuing on to page R18, teacher development and evaluation revenue. Mr. Wilms touched on this. This is roughly $10 million revenue entitlement for fiscal year 2015, distributed to school districts in which school districts that do not in that fiscal year receive alternative teacher compensation revenue. It's distributed on a per FTE teacher basis. Continuing vision therapy pilot project in Section 95. This, again, as Mr. Williams touched on briefly, it's a three-year program to fund vision therapy pilot projects in up to two school districts, one of which shall be Centennial School District and the other of which is a district outside of the seven-county metro area or a city of the first class. That brings us to, go ahead, Tim.
Mr. Chair, members, the appropriations were mentioned earlier on the bottom of page R19 for the career and technical program inventory, $150,000 on the House side. On the top of the next page, $25,000 is appropriated for the teacher professional pay system and teacher evaluation program.
And then continuing with the appropriations, Mr. Chair, members, we have the Northwest Online College and High School program, $160,000 in 2015, one time. The Information Technology Certification Partnership, one time $340,000 in 2015, one time $500,000 for grants for vision therapy pilot projects. Legislative report on K-12 students' PE experience, one time $73,000, and the current year payment of $9 million. Related to the teacher development and evaluation revenue. That concludes Article 8, Article 17.
Questions on Article 17? All right. If we want to go on to 18.
Mr. Chairman, members, Article 18 has to do with special education. Section 1 on the House side contains provisions related to standards for restrictive procedures. There is a requirement that school districts inform the public about district restrictive procedure plans and provide staff training. Also, the date by which stakeholders annually must recommend goals to the commissioner and for reducing the use of restrictive procedures and by when the commissioner must report to the legislature were modified from March 1, 2014 to February 1, 2015. And there is also a requirement beginning in the 14-15 school year that school districts collect and submit to the education commissioner summary data on district use of reasonable force that is consistent with the definition of physical holding and seclusion of a child.
Mr. Chair, members, starting on page R6, then section 2 and section 43 of the House and Senate are the same. These have to do with some technical changes to align the special education, the new special education funding system with the general education changes that were made last year. On the following page, R8, Section 3 of the House and Section 44 of the Senate are similar on the top part of the page with the technical correction, but then the difference shows up on page R9. If you look at the top there of R9 on the House side, you'll see that here is where the one-to-one licensed certified professionals assigned to children attending the Minnesota State Academies for the Deaf and Blind in Faribault appear in statute. Section 4, Mr. Chair, also continues this change. Again, you can see the new language at the bottom of that page there. And again, this relates to the Minnesota State Academies for the Deaf and Blind and the requirement and funding for the additional one-to-one licensed certified professionals. Mr. Chair, members, then going to Section 5, which starts on the bottom of page R10. Again, cleanup payment the same in the House, cleanup language rather the same in the House and the Senate related to the treatment of pupil transportation expenditures under the new special education funding system. Section 6 of the House and 46 of the Senate, starting on the bottom of page R11, are the same in the two bills, and again, cleanup language related to last year's special education change. The same applies for Section 7 of the House and Section 47 of the Senate and Section 8 of the House and Section 48 of the Senate on the page as R12 and R13. Finally, Mr. Chair, on the technical changes, when we Sections 9 and 10 of the two bills on the House side and Sections 49 and 50 of the Senate on pages R14 and R15 are the same.
Mr. Chairman, members, Section 11 in the House, Section 78 in the Senate are similar but not the same. They both affect a 2013 general fund appropriation of $1,763,000 to the department to reduce paperwork costs. The 2013 appropriation has been amended to allow for the provision of an online special education due process reporting system. The new language directs the education commissioner in the House to customize the statewide online system to collect and report required special education data to individuals with a legitimate educational interest who are authorized by law to access the data. There is a list of online system outcomes. They include reducing teachers' paperwork burden, efficiently and effectively transmitting student records, avoiding fragmented service delivery, addressing language and other barriers and disparities, and helping to improve the interface among online systems serving children with disabilities. The commissioner is directed to use federal OSEP model forms to customize the state-sponsored special education system. There is an RFP process that the commissioner is directed to participate in to contract for needed technology and software. The online system is intended to be available to school districts without charge beginning in the 2015-2016 school year. School districts would be able to use either the online system or contract with an outside vendor between 2015-2016 and 2017-2018, and beginning in the 2018-2019 school year, would be required to use this system for compliance reporting. The House proposes to limit individuals' access to online data It prohibits a district from entering data on a student into the system if the student or parent refuses, and it directs the commissioner to establish a public internet web interface to provide information about special education, respond to queries, and to use the information to revise the reporting system. Finally, there is a direction to the commissioner to report annually to the legislature on the status, changes, and sustainability of that system. Mr. Chairman, members, in both the House and the Senate, there is language that actually resulted from a task force that the legislature established in 2013 to look at caseload limits. And in this particular section, there is a direction to the Commissioner of Education to use expedited rulemaking to make specific rule changes that were identified in the task force report to the legislature. There is a cross-reference in the language in both the House and the Senate that would require a public hearing if 100 people were to request it.
Mr. Chair, members, just note that this rulemaking authority is present in the Senate Education Policy Bill.
Mr. Chair, members, finally, there's an appropriation on the House side on page R20, the last section of this article, section 13, of $250,000 that goes along with the prone restraint provision that was the first section Ms. Larson addressed in this article.
Thanks.
And that's it for this article.
Any questions on Article 19? Okay, and then. I'm sorry, Article. So now we're at. Article 19.
Article 19, Mr. Chair and members, begins page R1-A19. The first section has to do with the Joint Powers Cooperative Facility. This section continues through the middle of the next page. It authorizes a collection of school districts to agree to jointly operate a secondary facility. Specifies how the allocation of levy to build a secondary facility, for example, would be determined according to a joint powers agreement. It governs the transfer of employees between joint powers members. It describes the bond election and sale. It is also related to the next section. Beginning at the middle of page R2, the consolidation transition aid. This new language authorizes, in addition to those districts that are consolidating per current law, it authorizes the use of this aid, access of this aid to those districts that are operating a cooperative facility, as I just described. It expands the allowed uses to include repaying building debt and increases the per pupil allowance and the time period over which a district can generate this revenue. Continuing on the bottom of page R3, duty to maintain elementary and secondary schools. This is basically conforming change to that provides that a district maintaining a jointly operated secondary facility in District A, for example, districts B and C. Would have met their otherwise statutory requirement to operate a secondary facility within their district. Continuing on the middle of page 4, section 4 on the House side, section 10 on the Senate side, debt service definitions. It defines eligible debt service revenue excludes the portion of taconite payments from the Iron Range School Consolidation Cooperatively Operated School Account. This account was created in a bill earlier this session. The note that the Senate language here also makes a reference to the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund. This is a technical drafting error attributable to yours truly. It should have been deleted from this language based on the final enacted language of the first tax bill. It also excludes, at the bottom of page R4, the obligations equalized under section 123B.535. That's the natural disaster debt service equalization referenced earlier.
Mr. Chair, members, starting on page R5, section 5 of the House, both the House and Senate were assigned a zero levy target for the out years, and as a result, equalizing factors were changed to balance any levy increases authorized. On the Senate side, as we discussed in Article 16, the operating capital levy equalizing factor was increased to reduce the levy in that program. Here in Section 5, the Senate has chosen the debt service, or the House has chosen the debt service levy and increases the equalizing factors here by a corresponding amount so that the net levy for the House stays at zero for the overbase for the out years as well. Section 6 is the natural disaster debt service equalization program. Essentially, what's happening here is that a school district that's been affected by a natural disaster and meets the qualifying characteristics may qualify for equalization aid under this program. Essentially, this is a souped-up level of equalization compared to the regular debt service equalization program. Once the school district hits a level of local tax effort greater than 10 percentage points, which you can find on page R6, line 195.13, then this new program kicks in, and essentially the equalization then is set at a level that's equal to three times the state average, which I believe is around $18,000 or thereabouts for the using the current data. This is the 300% of the statewide adjusted net tax capacity is on line 195.22. So essentially what happens under this program, if a district has a natural disaster and needs to rebuild a school facility, if they meet the qualifying characteristics, then they get higher levels of debt equalization under the program. Section 7 and 12 of the House and Senate, respectively, starting on page R7, includes the amounts necessary for this equalization in the open and standing appropriation for the debt service equalization program. Section 8 starts at the bottom of page R7 and has to do with the health and safety program. The changes appear on page R8, starting on line 197.1. Essentially, what happens here is that the House language authorizes a school district to include in its health and safety plan any costs necessary to comply with the new emission standards for school generators. These are the peak load generators, essentially, that many school districts have and run sporadically when the company that otherwise would provide their power is at a peak load situation. To keep this revenue neutral, however, on lines 197.8 through 197.11, a school district that for the next 3 years wants to access this health and safety revenue is required to reduce another qualifying health and safety project by the same amount. Mr. Chair, members, the next change then is Section 9, which is quite similar to Section 13 of the Senate. This has to do with some early recommendations from the Task Force on School Facilities and the review and comment process. A couple of things going on here. On line 197.19, the minimum size of a qualifying construction project is raised to $2 million, so that any project below $2 million essentially is not required to get a review and comment. There's another change in the repealer where the commissioner had authority to review any project over $500,000. That's removed. But essentially the main change here is from $1.4 to $2 million on the size of a project that needs to be addressed. And then additionally, certain capital projects funded from other funding sources are also exempt from the review and comment. In Section 10, then, the list of information that's to be required is where the difference is. And you can see that the lists are written just slightly differently, but essentially are the same items just put in slightly different format. Mr. Chair, members, starting on the bottom or the top of page R11, Section 11, This is a provision related to the Crosswind School, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and this requires that declining enrollment not apply to a school district for the portion of the students who are otherwise enrolled at the Crosswind School for fiscal years 15 through 17. This essentially ensures that the Crosswinds transfer, as it is in this in both bills, is revenue slightly less than revenue neutral. It's under, actually saves a little bit of money by doing it this way, but it keeps that provision essentially of not having a fiscal cost.
Mr. Chair, members, continuing on page R 11, section 64 on the Senate side, this is the building lease levy. Increased allowances can be found in the middle of page R12 at line 14 for a school district and at line 31 for the additional authority for a district that's a member of an intermediate school district. Point of information, there are roughly half a dozen districts that are currently at the lease levy cap. We continue on to the middle of page R13. Taconite payments and other reductions, similar language between the House and Senate here. The new language in the middle of Clause 3 provides that payments from the Iron Range School Consolidation and Cooperatively Operated School Account may reduce a district's debt levy by more than 50%. Continuing on to the middle of page R14, abatements. The new language is in the middle of page R15, and it simply adds to the list of levies included in the abatement calculation the natural disaster debt service equalization under 123B.535. Kind of a similar thing in the next section, excess tax increment. You see the new language in the middle of page R16, conceptually similar. We add the natural disaster debt service equalization to this list for the purposes of excess tax increment calculations. Section 15 on the House side, we're on to page R17. Mr. Chair, members, Section 50 on the House side and Section 72 on the Senate side are the same. They describe the powers and duties of the board, meaning, in this case, the Perpich Center for Arts Education Board. This is related to the Crosswinds conveyance to Perpich. Page R19, Section 16 on the House side, corresponding with Section 73 on the Senate side. This is again related to Perpich. It authorizes the Perpich Board to establish and operate an inter-district integration magnet program and requires that for fiscal 16 and later, the board must have an approved achievement and integration plan and budget. Continuing to the bottom of page R19, Section 17 and Section 74, Crosswinds Integration Magnet School. This basically kind of lays out the structure within which the Crosswind School operates inside of as a complement to Perpich's other programming. I have a simple definitions. We authorize the board to operate the Crosswind School, specify how general education funding is calculated for the Crosswinds School, special education funding, likewise pupil transportation. For fiscal 15 only, a member district of the Joint Powers District, East Metro Integration District, has the responsibility of transporting pupils. For fiscal 16 and beyond, the pupil transportation would be the ultimate responsibility of the Perpich Board, but would be reimbursable under the existing achievement and integration statutes. I should note that the difference in language here in the middle of page R20 is that the Senate language prorates the equity revenue for the Crosswinds, for pupils enrolled at Crosswinds in order to in order to hit the appropriation number on the tracking sheet. That brings us, Mr. Chair and members, to R21, Section 75, Iron Range School Consolidation and Cooperative Operated School Account. The new language actually comes at the top of page R22 and provides that beginning in fiscal 19, the disbursement to school districts for payments for bonds be increased each year to offset any reduction in debt service equalization aid relative to the amount the school district qualified for in fiscal 18. So the sort of practical scenario would be that in 2020, the property values in that part of the state changed such that districts in that region were eligible for less equalized aid, relatively speaking. This language requires the school account to offset that reduced aid to bring them whole relative to fiscal year 2018.
Mr. Chair, members, on page R22, on the left side of the page, section 18, is where the House increases the telecommunications access aid for school districts from $3.75 to $8.75 million dollars per year beginning in fiscal year 2015.
Mr. Chair and members, at the bottom of page R22, the fiscal year 2015 lease levy authority in the Senate language, this is the lease levy authority that that we previously described takes effect for fiscal year 2016. This section 87 would give districts that wish to make a levy for revenue in fiscal 15 the ability to do so. According to the department's fiscal note, we expect that those roughly half dozen districts that I mentioned earlier that are at the cap would choose to make this levy. That levy would be recognized as revenue in 2015 and also paid in taxes payable 15. The middle page, R23, Harambe Community School Transition. It's kind of a parallel section to what you earlier saw with regard to the crosswinds to Perpich transition. It clarifies how student enrollment works, how compensatory revenue and other revenue streams are calculated in terms of pupil counts, authorizes Harambe Community School to operate as a year-round program, and makes similar clarification about whose responsibility it is to transport pupils enrolled at the Harambe School. Similar parallel section for Crosswind School begins at the bottom of page R23. At the top of page R24, the department language directs the Department of Education to qualify the Crosswind School for Title I and other applicable federal funding, as if the program were still operated by the EMID joint powers. Continuing on the middle of page R24, section 21 on the House side and section 90 on the Senate side, similar language here that authorizes the Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan School District to build a satellite transportation hub using lease levy authority. The only substantial difference here is that the authorities in the Senate language, the authority is conditioned on the district's ability to demonstrate to the commissioner that the satellite hub results in a significant financial savings. And finally, the repealer on page R24 has to do with the reform of the review and comment provisions described earlier. That concludes Article 19.
Questions on the article? Okay, Article 20.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 20 is the nutrition article on the House side. This starts on page R1 of Article 20. The first section increases the funding in both the House and the Senate bill for reduced-price meals by the 40 cents that's currently now borne by the students who qualify for reduced-price lunch. This provision is effective beginning in fiscal year 2015. Both bills also have the same next provision, Section 2 of the House and Section 21 of the Senate, that essentially requires a school district that receives or other participant in the lunch program that receives a funding under this to ensure that any reminders for outstanding student balances are made in a way that does not demean or stigmatize the child.
Mr. Chair, members, continuing on the Senate side of the page, R1, inability to pay. The Senate language encourages participants in the federal school lunch program to provide any enrolled student who is unable to pay with the same lunch that is served to other students, rather than an alternative meal. Section 23 increases the reimbursement from the state to school districts, to participants in the school breakfast program, for lunches served to kindergarten students. It is a complement to Section 24 following that requires that participants in the school breakfast program serve breakfast free of charge to all kindergarten students, regardless of their income status otherwise. Section 3 on the House side and Section 79 on the Senate side are the school lunch appropriations. Section 80 on the Senate side is the school breakfast appropriation. That concludes Article 20.
Article 21.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 21 is the Early Education, Community Ed, and Self-Sufficiency article. The first section on the House side has to do with developmental screening aid. School districts are reimbursed depending on the age of the student when that student is first screened. The House bill increases the reimbursement levels for those that are screened at ages 3 and 4 by $5 per pupil screened, beginning in fiscal year 15.
Mr. Chair, beginning in the middle of page R1, there's going to be a series of sections on the Senate side, all relating to early childhood family education programs. So we have program requirements describing the components of the programs. There's new language at the middle of page R2, new language again in the middle of page R3. Continuing on to Section 28, program data submission requirements, requires that districts receiving revenue, ECFU revenue, submit their annual program data, including data that demonstrates the program response to the community needs assessment. Continuing on to page R4, supervision requires that an ECFE program be supervised by a licensed early childhood teacher or licensed parent educator. Section 30 provides that as funds are sufficient, ECFE can provide parenting education transition programming for parents of children birth to grade 3 where certain conditions are in effect. Section 31 deals with early childhood family education revenue. As Mr. Wilms described earlier, the new language at lines 30 and 31 increase the per pupil allowance for ECFE revenue, and beginning in fiscal year 15 and beyond, indexes that per pupil allowance to future changes in the basic formula allowance. Down near the bottom of page R4, section 32 on the Senate side simply strikes obsolete language.
Mr. Chair, members, starting on the very bottom of page R4 and continuing on page R5 on the House side, the statutory language creating the school readiness program is amended on the House side to include the aid entitlement amount for the school readiness program. Currently, that program is, the revenue is driven by the amount actually appropriated for it. This puts that amount in statute, and when we get to the appropriation, you'll see the differences there. Essentially, the House increases it in the statutory amount by just under $2 million in this section of law.
Mr. Chair and members, now we're to page R5, section 33 on the Senate side. This is the section relating to the early learning scholarships administration. The new language at lines 20 through 23, strike the $5,000 per child cap and directs the commissioner to establish a target for the average scholarship amount. I should note that this language, I believe, is identical to language that is in the House in the Women's Economic Security Act, the language in paragraph B. The new language in paragraph C enables a school district or Head Start program qualifying under the early learning program to use their established registration process to enroll scholarship recipients. And I think the intent there is to eliminate some what might be duplicative paperwork between these established programs and the early learning scholarship program itself. And finally, the new language on page R6, paragraph F, authorizes school districts or Head Start programs enrolling scholarship recipients to apply to the commissioner rather for direct payment of state aid rather than working with a scholarship administrator to receive that aid. Page R6, section 34 on the Senate side provides that all Minnesota Early Learning Foundations or MELF scholarship program pilot sites are eligible to accept an early learning scholarship. Continuing on, Mr. Chair, members, to page R7, report required. This is the early learning scholarship report. Both the House and the Senate require the report to be submitted to the legislature by January 15th, 2016. The Senate language provides some more prescriptive requirements as to the content of the report. Pay particular attention to lines 32 through 162.3 of that subdivision. Continuing through page R7, section 4 on the House side, section 36 on the Senate side, increases, you'll see the new language is at near the bottom of the page. On the Senate, on the House side, it's page 212.32. It increases the proportion of the total supplemental services aid that can be granted to a single organization. This was a provision from the governor's bill. Continuing to page R8, this is where Ms. Johnson previously referenced the restoration of the ABE, or Adult Basic Education Annual Growth Factor, to 1.03. This is an identical provision in both the House and Senate language. The bottom of page R8, program revenue. This is a conforming change. The stricken and new language is at the top of page R9. It adjusts the H threshold below which federal census counts of the number of adults without a diploma is counted. And my understanding is that this is simply to conform with the way that the federal census classifies age ranges with regard to educational attainment. Then we have school readiness appropriations. We previously saw those appropriations with the walkthrough and the tracking sheet. ECFE aid, similarly.
Mr. Chair, members, then on the top of the next page, R10, the health and developmental screening aid appropriation increase is the same as the tracking sheet. And one point of reference for those of you unfamiliar with the K-12 appropriations, best to use the tracking sheets to see the actual change in dollars because the K-12 area works under a budgeting rule where any forecast adjustments are reflected in the number. So sometimes, as Ms. Johnson said, this health and developmental screening aid is about a $250,000 aid entitlement increase. But from looking at the appropriation, you'd see a slightly different number there because the base number also gets adjusted for forecasts. And this is true throughout the article. So when comparing the actual changes, best to rely on the spreadsheet to determine the differences.
Mr. Chair and members, continuing on through the appropriations, we have the early childhood education scholarships, early learning scholarships, the parent-child home program. That's a one-year, one-time-only increase relative to forecast of $100,000. The ABE aid. At the bottom of page R11, we come to the appropriations for the Northside Achievement Zone. And following the St. Paul Promise neighborhood, those appropriations are different and different into the forecast period. It was covered when we walked through the spreadsheet. And I believe that concludes Article 21.
Thanks. Article 22.
Mr. Chair, members, in Article 22, the House makes some adjustments that we talked about to the Department's of Education's budget. This section reflects some of those changes here that show up in the tracking sheet. Essentially, the ones that you're seeing here are set aside where they correspond to Senate changes. The appropriation is moved there. But you can see the ones that Ms. Johnson talked about earlier, the increase in the Board of Teaching, the increase for the Board of School Administrators, the payment for fiscal year 15 only for the Works Museum, and for the Headwater Science Center, starting on the top of page R2. And then finally, Mr. Chair, in the appropriation for the department, a line item appropriation on page R2 on lines 216 through 220, lines 21 through 22, the $25,000 was the amount that was in the laws for the innovation pilot programs that were passed in 2012. And this is clarifying that that amount each year is available for that purpose. Mr. Chair, members, the next appropriation is for the state academies. Both bills increase that by the same amount. And Mr. Chair, members, Section 3 is the Health Insurance Transparency Act appropriation. Here, the only difference is capitalization of Health Insurance Transparency Act. And Mr. Chair, that's a summary of Article 22.
Okay, and then finally, Article 23.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 23 is the forecast adjustment article. These changes align the remaining K-12 appropriations with forecast changes. There's no cost over base or savings to base from these changes as they align the appropriations with the amount actually included in the February 14 forecast.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chair, just to amplify what Mr. Strom just went through, there are a few differences in House versus Senate. We discovered as the Senate bill was about to be passed that there were some conforming changes that needed to be made in a few of the appropriations to adjust the lagging payment in 13. So the lagging payment for fiscal 14 is actually attributable to 13, and those adjustments were made in about 8 or 9 cases. So I think we'll need to touch base with MMB on which are the correct versions to carry.
Are there questions from the Conference Committee for any of the education staff on the articles we've gone through? Okay, if not, thank you very much. So the finale is Health and Human Services. Mr. Berg, I guess you're on your own.
Mr. Chairman, I'm in for Human Services. We'll make it quick.
Really?
Yeah, that's.
If it's okay, I thought Mr. Albrecht will be here in just a second. We thought we would start with a run through the spreadsheet and then have the legal staff run through the articles, if that works for you.
Sure.
I'm Doug Berg. I'm fiscal analyst for the House of Representatives for Human Services. Members should have, I think, at the start of their sections or at the start of the book for the Senate members, a spreadsheet that is labeled 2014 Session Budget Proposal Tracking. There he is. They are, I will apologize in advance, they are not absolutely identical. The House and Senate ones are one line off on their numbers. We'll try to remember that when we do that, but they're almost identical. And you're on.
Mr. Chair and members.
We're almost finished, Mr. Albrecht, so.
We're almost finished.
Don't you get more staff than this? To orient you to this spreadsheet, the House position is in the center, six columns, and the Senate's position is on the right-hand side. on line seven are the total all funds amounts for everything in the bill. the House total is 186,953. I'm sorry. 98,623,000, and the Senate's total is 103,310. On lines 18 to 35, you can see the activity and balances in the Healthcare Access Fund and in the TANF Fund. And on lines 30 to 35, those are the amounts for each of the major components of the medical assistance program. The first of the change items is on page 2. On line 108 is the home and community-based services provider rate increase of 5%. That's about $80 million for both the House and the Senate. On line 122 is a nursing facility rate adjustment. That's $2.1 million in the House and the Senate. Line 128 is a House-only provision, a nursing facility rate increase of 5% on July 1st, 2015. Line 132 is also a House position. It's a nursing facility rate increase for specified counties, for facilities in specified counties. Line 136 is a Senate position that provides additional money to a current law critical access nursing facilities program. Line 140 is a House provision that relates to a nursing facility level of care appeals process. Line 144 is the first of several Senate positions that show no dollars on the spreadsheet, Mr. Chair, but represent bills that came to the committee with money attached to them, and that money was removed in the process of the committee considering them. This one relates to the HCBS rate-setting methodology changes that were enacted last year. Line 148 is a House position that delays an autism benefit until July 1st of 2014. The changes were enacted last year. Line 152 is a House position that reduces TEFRA fees, I believe, in calendar year 2015. Line 158 is a Senate position that is tied with provisions in the Department of Health that you'll see later. This is to provide medical coverage for uninsured children below 275% of the federal poverty guideline. Line 164 is a Senate position that repeals a current law 10% fee-for-service hospital rate reduction beginning November 1st, 2014. Line 169 is a House position. It is the contents of House File 2556, which includes housing moratorium exceptions. Line 174 is a no money item that is a governor's recommendation that's also in the House and the Senate positions for healthcare payment modernization. This is also known as hospital rate rebasing. On page 3, Mr. Chair, on line 177 is a House and Senate provision that clarifies the facilities eligible for a exemption from a hospital rate reduction for children's hospitals. Line 181 is a delay in presumptive eligibility changes that were enacted last year until July 1st, 2014. Line 185 is a House provision that is tied to the change above that would provide hospitals a 3% rate increase for 6 months from July 1st of 2014 until December 31st of 2014. Line 189 is a Senate position that makes some changes to mental health crisis intervention services. Line 194 is a governor's recommendation and a House and Senate position to develop a detox services plan. That's to try and enhance the funding for those services, actually. Line 199 is a Senate provision relating to adult mental health grants. This is to make intensive community rehab rehabilitation services an MA benefit, provisionally beginning on May 1st, 2016. So it would go from a grant program until then and then become an MA benefit. Line 205 is a House and Senate position regarding a personal needs allowance that allows certain individuals to exempt child support payments from their income calculations. I'm sorry, their spousal maintenance from their income calculation. Line 210 is a House position that increases the income eligibility level for elderly and disabled waiver programs to 80% of the federal poverty guideline beginning January 1st, 2017. Line 214 is a House position relating to GR group residential housing eligibility for a facility in Stearns County. Line 218 is a Senate provision with no money requiring the commissioner to publish and seek public comment on state plan amendments. Line 222 is a House and Senate position that would create a Civil Commitment Act training, online training for interested individuals. Line 226 is a Senate position for a working group to develop recommendations for a facility for mentally ill offenders who come into contact with the police. Line 230 is a House position to do a child care professional development study. Line 235 is a House and Senate position that makes changes to the MFIP educational requirements. Line 242 is a House position that moves up by 6 months, a provision enacted last year for the MFIP family cap repeal. Moving on to the next page, on line 246 is a Senate position that addresses a uniform public assistance program eligibility requirements. Line 257 is a Senate position that provides for $1 million worth of nursing facility moratorium exception projects. Line 261 is a Senate and House position that sets the Healthcare Access Fund base rider for an appropriation to the medical assistance program for 2016 and 2017. And line 267 is a governor's recommendation that's in both the House and Senate bills to correct what's known as the PIP, the Performance Improvement Payment Program for HCBS providers, to make it clear that it is intended to be a forecast program.
And, Mr. Chairman, I'll continue on line 270. 5 and is a governor's recommendation on medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities. I note this, neither the House or Senate has it in, but this was a change to the governor's recommendation just a week or so, or maybe 2 weeks ago, was added to the governor's position. On line 283 is an exception to the home and community-based housing moratorium. There are two of these. The House and Senate both approach this problem in different ways. The House provides for a one-time process which would allow exceptions of up to 200 units. If you look on line 289, the Senate has a different provision which would take effect in the tails to set up a moratorium process, which I don't think has a limit on the number of beds, but is limited by facility, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, the Senate's position relates to just one facility.
One facility. Mr. Chairman, on line 293 is technical changes to the Community First Services supports policy and program. This is this could be much like some other items that don't show any cost. You see it nets to zero. This is a governor's recommendation. Both houses have it. Because of federal recommendations in the Reform 2020 process last year and some other issues with the federal government, the change we made last year from the old PCA program to Community First Services needed some substantial revision, administrative revision in the law. You'll see that the dollars there show a reduction and an expenditure that exactly match. It's just showing that there are some substantial changes to the administrative, the law around the program that's going to cost exactly the same amount at the end of the day as we anticipated it would. Moving on to line 298 is the Jensen settlement compliance item. This is related to the what's typically known as the Mito settlement, which involved restraint of patients in state facilities. This involves more training and follow-up of individuals who were released from the Minnesota specialty healthcare system. The House has got the same recommendation as the governor. The Senate takes the language but actually trimmed some of the staffing out of the proposal. Moving on to line page 5 and line 314, this is part of the Safe Harbor for Sexually Exploited Youth program. Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, I did the heading at the bottom of page 4, which is actually line 310 on page 4, but the item shows on the top of page 5, is a technical correction to the North Star child care adoption program. It involves the amount of time that foster families have to be licensed to be in the program, and it has a minor fiscal impact. The House, Senate, and Governor are all the same on that. On line 314 is the Safe Harbor for Sexually Exploited Youth program. This portion will come on another portion at the Department of Health. The part that is at Department of Human Services is for housing for sexually exploited youth. The House has $569,000 ongoing for that, and the Senate has $500,000. On line 318, both the House and Senate have permanent funding for the Homeless Youth Act, just slightly different levels. On line 322 is the CARE deficiency funding request of the governor's. CARE is the Community Addiction Recovery Enterprise Program, which deals with complex addiction cases. The House and Senate, both the governor's proposal was to fund a deficiency in the program by diverting $4 million in administrative funds each year in their chemical dependency programs to care of individuals. The governor added $1 million a year of general fund money to that. The House and Senate both take the governor's proposal to spend the dedicated administrative funding but do not add the general fund bump to it. On line 333 is a governor's recommendation that we fix in law the rate for the Andrew residence. The Andrew residence is a facility, transition facility for people, many coming out of the security hospital who are transitioning to a community setting. They have mental health issues, and they have been receiving a rate for many years, which the auditor said is not fully backed up by the law. The law now will back up the rate so that these individuals can continue to be in this facility, or the facility can continue to get the rate, actually. On line 336, both the House and Senate have funding for senior nutrition programs. The House has $579,000 permanent funding. The House has the Senate has a one-time increase of $250,000. On line 340 is a governor's item, the coordination of benefits registry. This would have Minnesota enter into a multi-state registry that helps us identify third-party insurance so that in cases where there might be a third party to bill, the state can find out about that, and it has a slight savings. Item on line 350 is the governor's item for a salary supplement at the state-operated services and security hospital. And then on line 356 is a salary supplement for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program that the governor recommended. Neither the House or Senate have picked up those items. On line 361 is the governor's recommendation for funding the Minnesota Sex Offender Expert Review that was ordered by the federal judge in the class action suit. The House did not pick up that item. The Senate funded it at a lower level. Moving on to the Department of Health, on line 533, there are a series of a couple of technical adjustments. Well, one is settlement of a legal suit, which is the Bearder lawsuit over the state's newborn screening program. The governor recommended funding that. The House and Senate both fund that item, but do it with the general fund. The governor had healthcare access fund used for that. And then there is a correction on line 538 of what was a duplicate appropriation from the Healthcare Access Fund. And so there was a statutory appropriation and a direct appropriation. One of them is eliminated. On line 540 is the other part of the Safe Harbor for Sexually Exploited Youth program that I mentioned. The Health Department's role in this is grants to regional coordinators who have plans for outreach to prevent sexual exploitation of youth. On line 544, both the House and Senate have funding at different levels for the Healthy Homes Program. This deals with lead and other home contaminants. Moving on to page 6. Is the healthcare grants on line 552 is the healthcare grants for uninsured individuals item that Mr. Albrecht referred to. The Senate has $2 million for a series of different purposes that we'll get to, I think, when we get to the rider on it. But there are several items contained within that the money would go towards. The item on line 556 is another, the healthcare quality measures plan is another one that, as Mr. Albrecht referred to, there was funding for the plan originally. This includes the plan for quality measures in healthcare. It doesn't include the funding at this point. The line 560, there is a healthcare workforce study item on the House side. It's $75,000 one time to set up a commission to study healthcare workforce issues. I'll note that this is in the House bill at the Health Department, but if this item moves forward, it likely would make more sense to appropriate this money to the Legislative Coordinating Commission in the state government article. But this is where it is currently in the bill. On line 564 is House-only provision to add money to the base of the Minnesota Poison Information Center. Line 568 is an item that both the House and the Senate have. It does not have a cost. It changes the definition in the rural, the Health Professional Loan Forgiveness Program of what rural means. It doesn't change the funding in the program. It just changes the definition of what is rural. On line 572 is an item that both the House and Senate have at different levels, a women's health equity grant that involves Somali health equity issues. And I'll note that this item and the three below it on the House side are kind of grouped into a minority health equities item in the House bill. In addition to the women's health equity grant, then on line 576, the House has an item that provides dementia outreach grants to go to minority communities. On line 580 is a funding for a mental health conference aimed at mental health issues in minority and immigrant communities. And then there is on line 584 an undesignated pool of funds for the Department of Health to provide grants just going at various different minority health equity issues. On line 588 is a House-only provision that would allow the Leech Lake Band to upgrade its equipment to so that its ambulance service could be licensed as an advanced life support service. On line 592 is an item that both the House and Senate have, which is an exception to the hospital construction moratorium. It involves a 16-bed mental health facility in Thief River Falls. On line 601 is the governor's integrated home care licensing provision. This is allowing the Department of Health to integrate their licensure systems so that people who operate under two different licenses, home and community-based service providers and home care providers, would only need to be licensed once and not twice. On line 606 is the governor's item on spoken language interpreter. The governor and the House and Senate all do the basic item, which improves the registry. The Department of Health keeps a registry of spoken language interpreters for health matters. The House has an additional part on line 609, which requires the Department of Health to develop a plan to expand the purposes of the registry. And when we get to the riders, you'll see the language around that. On line 611 is the governor's item for appropriation for food, beverage, and lodging, which is the Department of Health about a year ago took over inspections in the city of St. Paul, which had previously been done by Ramsey County. They're charging the fees for this now, but they don't have the appropriations authority to spend the money, so that's what this does. And then on line 615 and down, there are a series of technical corrections at the health department. One of them moves in last year's SHIP funding. There was an evaluation required. The spreadsheet showed 25,000 each year. The rider said that there was 50,000 in the second year, so this just moves the money over. There is some money that is being collected by Department of Health on state government special revenue fund monies coming from fees that they just don't have the appropriation authority to spend, but they are collecting it. There was an item where there was a there was a direct appropriation of some dedicated funding in last year that shouldn't have happened. It's actually statutorily appropriated, so that's corrected. And there is an issue around fees for the infectious disease lab. We ended the fee appropriation early. They're moving that from a fee-based structure to a contract-based structure. The date in last year's bill was wrong. So we have to allow, they're still collecting the fee, and again, we just have to give them the appropriation authority to spend the money they're collecting under current law until the fee system ends. And then finally, Mr. Chair, on line 817, They, both the House and Senate have an increase in the base appropriation for the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. The House increases it $100,000 a year and permanently, and the Senate increases it $150,000 in fiscal year 15 and permanently. And that is the spreadsheet, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions on the spreadsheet? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Berg and Mr. Albrecht. All right, if we can go to the language for Health and Human Services. And as we've done, maybe just introduce yourself to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jamie Olson. I'm with House Research.
And I'm Katie Kavanaugh with Senate Counsel.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and members, the House Research and Senate Counsel has put together a bill summary comparison that you do have in your packets. I believe they're in the back of the binders on the House side. I apologize. I'm not sure where they are. Are they in there? Wonderful. So we will be working on that. If you prefer the side-by-side, we do have the page numbers written down if you just want to let us know. We starting with Article 24, which is the Health Department.
Yes. Yeah, I know.
Section 1 in Article 24 relates to the rural area for purposes of the Health Professional Loan Forgiveness Program. This is a provision that is only in the Senate side. I will note that the House does have this in House File 2402, which is the policy omnibus bill for Health and Human Services, and that identical language exists in that bill. Section 1 on the House side, Section 2 on the Senate side, is an exception to the hospital moratorium for a 16-bed psychiatric hospital in the city of Thief River Falls. House Section 2, Senate Section 3, is for the Healthy Housing Grants. This section creates grants for the education and training of persons engaged in addressing housing-based issues. The only difference between the House and Senate language is Subdivision 4, which the Senate has, which creates healthy home implementation grants in addition to the education grants. House Section 3, Senate Section 4, is an integrated licensure, and it creates an integrated licensure for those people who are providing home-based services. What this does, is requires the Commissioner of Health to enforce home and community-based services standards for providers who also have a home care license. There are technical differences between the House and the Senate language. We do recommend taking the Senate language on this because they did have the most updated version of the language from the Department of Health. And that includes Subdivision 9, which requires the Department of Health to study and report on client bills of rights. The House has this as codified language in Subdivision 9, and the Senate has it as uncodified language.
House Section 4 and Senate Section 5, these sections expand the duties of the Director of Child Sex Trafficking Prevention to include managing the requests for proposals for grants for comprehensive services. These sections are identical in both House and Senate. House Section 5 and Senate Section 6 require the home care provider's license by the Department of Health with a home community-based services designation to designate a compliance officer. There are technical differences between the House and the Senate, but otherwise identical. The House Section 6, it's a House-only section. This establishes a legislative health care workforce commission to study and provide recommendations to the legislature on how to strengthen the health care workforce. House Section 7 establishes grants programs to address minority health disparities.
These grant programs requires the Commissioner of Health to distribute grants for purposes of including dementia training and education, a training conference on immigrant and refugee mental health, and other programs prioritized by the Commissioner of Health relating to health disparities in minority populations.
That's your first one.
House Section 8, and then Senate Section, which is in Article 14, Section 3. This prohibits the Department of Health from hiring more than one full-time employee to administer the healthy housing grants. This language is identical except for placement. Then Senate Section 7, this is a Senate-only provision. This requires the Commissioner of Health to award health care grants to dental providers and community mental health programs that provide free or reduced care
to
low-income patients with income below 200% of federal poverty guidelines and who do not have health insurance coverage. The section also creates an emergency medical assistance outlier grant program for hospitals to assist in defraying underpayments associated with the emergency medical assistance program. And then Senate Section 8 is, again, another Senate-only provision. This requires the Commissioner of Health to develop an implementation plan for stratifying quality measures based on disability, race, ethnicity, language, and other socio-demographic factors that are correlated with health disparities and impact performance quality measures, and submit the plan to the legislature by January 15, 2015. And that is the Health Department.
Questions for either Ms. Olson or Ms. Cavanaugh relative to Department of Health? Okay, so if you want to continue.
Okay, from that.
That's it. Okay, Article 25.
Welcome. We'll,
Mr. Chair, Randy Chun with House Research.
Whichever one of you wants to start with the Section 25 or Article 25.
Mr. Chair, health care, again, we're going to be working on the side-by-side summary for the health care article, House Article 25, Senate Article 19.
I really like this.
House Section 1, Senate Section 1 are identical, and it allows the Commissioner of Human Services to contract with a national organization to match recipient third-party liability information and provide coverage and insurance information to the department. House Sections 2 and 3 and Senate Sections 2 and 3 are just strike obsolete references to the old General Assistance Medical Care Program. House Section 4 and Senate Section 4, well, I should back up, and these next sections, House Section 4 to 27 and Senate Section 4 to 26, they all deal with the hospital rebasing and changing the diagnostic codes in terms of inpatient hospital payments. Section 4, House Section 4, Senate Section 4 simply changes the reference to base year to years and eliminates the reference to GMC. House Section 5 and Senate Section 5 are identical, and it strikes language that prohibits the automatic annual inflation adjustments for hospital payments. It also strikes obsolete reference to the GMC program. House Section 6 and Senate Section 7 are identical. This directs the Commissioner to use the all-patient diagnosis-related groups or other similar classification programs to determine the relative values of inpatient services and case mix indices. Also removes the requirement to recategorize diagnostic classifications and recalculate the RVUs every 2 years. And again, this is for the inpatient hospital payments. House Section 7 and Senate Section 7, this establishes the new inpatient hospital payment system, and it delineates the four different categories of hospitals. It specifies that the critical access hospitals shall be paid using a cost-based methodology, and for all other hospitals except for long-term care hospitals
and rehab hospitals, they should be paid on a diagnostic-related group methodology. That's paragraph A. Paragraph B strikes language that prohibits hospital rates from being rebased. Paragraph C requires the rebased rate to use cost and payment methodologies in a manner similar to Medicare. It also specifies that the base year to be used for the rebasing is fiscal year 2012. And it requires rebasing to be budget neutral with separate budget neutrality calculations determined for payments to the critical access hospitals and payments to hospitals reimbursed under the DRG system. And it requires past rate increases and decreases to be considered in the budget neutrality calculation. Paragraph D, both the House and Senate, requires rebased rates to result in no greater than a 5% increase or decrease from the base year payments for any hospital. And it allows the commissioner to make rate adjustments to consider the impact of changes on specific sets of services and other factors. Then paragraph E then specifies the additional criteria that could be considered in the hospital payment rates. The differences in Section 7 between the House and the Senate, that the substantive differences is the implementation date. The House has the implementation for this new payment system of September 1, 2014. The Senate has October 1, 2014. And the other substantive difference is in paragraph C. The Senate adds a sentence that deals with the budget neutrality that specifies that in the budget neutrality factor, they must consider the estimated expenditures for fiscal years 2015 to 2017 and make sure that it equals the estimates in the February 2014 forecast, and the House does not have this provision. Turning to page 5, House Section 8 and Senate Section 8, this requires the commissioner to apply a budget neutrality factor to ensure that the total DRG payments to hospitals do not exceed the total DRG payments that would have been made had relative rates and weights not been calibrated. The difference here is some technical differences and then the implementation date again. House Section 9, Senate Section 9, allows the commissioner to implement an interim payment process for discharges if the new payment system and rebasing is not completed by a certain date. Again, the difference is in the implementation date. House Section 10, in Senate Section 10, this requires the commissioner to make reports to the legislature on the financial impacts and policy ramifications of the payment methodology. Again, there's a difference in the implementation date and some technical differences. House Section 11 and Senate Section 11, this requires historical rate adjustments to be incorporated into the rebased rates. And it requires the commissioner to notify hospitals of payment rates 30 days prior to implementation.
And then you broke.
Again, the implementation date is different and technical differences. House Section 12 and Senate Section 12. This updates references to the diagnosis codes for the hospital-acquired conditions and for certain other treatments. There are, again, some technical differences between the language, but substantively they're the same. House Section 13 and Senate Section 13.
The scholarships.
These sections deal with the current 10% ratable reduction to inpatient hospital rates. Both the House and the Senate include in the exemption to this ratable reduction the AMPLATS Children's Hospital. The House exempts from the rate reduction for the AMPLATS Hospital from the period of 9/1/2011 to August 31st, 2013. The Senate provides this exemption for the entire period that the rate reduction is in place. So it goes again retroactively to September 1, 2011, to the elimination of the rate reduction. And the Senate eliminates this rate reduction effective November 1st, 2014.
and the House keeps it in place until it is currently supposed to sunset, which is June 30th, 2015. House Section 14 is a House-only section. This increases the payment for fee-for-service inpatient hospital admissions by 3%. From July 2014 through December 31st, 2014. House Section 15, Senate Section 14. This requires the critical access hospitals that receive MA payments and hospitals that receive a disproportionate population adjustment to annually file MA cost reports within 6 months of the end of the hospital's fiscal year. There are technical differences between these two sections. House Section 16 and Senate Section 15 eliminates a references to a repealed subdivision. House Section 17, Senate Section 16 requires the commissioner to establish payment rates for acute transfers based on Medicare methodology. There's a difference in the implementation date and several technical differences. House Section 18 and Senate Section 17 strikes language related to short stay payments. Again, differences in the effective date and other technical differences. House Section 19 and Senate Section 18 requires payments of medically necessary care. These deals with the payments for hospital residents. For the first 180 days of inpatient care, it's based on DRG payments plus any appropriate outliers. And then the House requires that the payments for subsequent care after the 180 days be made at a rate computed at 80% of the product of a statewide average cost to charge ratio multiplied by the usual and customary charge. And the Senate, for the subsequent after the 180 days, the payment is based on a statewide cost to average ratio multiplied by the usual and customary charges. House Section 20 and Senate Section 19 eliminate obsolete language related to the disproportionate population adjustment payments. There are some technical differences here. House Section 21, Senate Section 20 requires hospitals to exclude certified registered nurse anesthetist costs from hospital operating payment rates. These are identical sections. House Section 22, Senate Section 21 requires the commissioner, to the extent possible, to replicate the payment rate methodology under the new diagnostic classification system when establishing relative values for the rehabilitation hospitals. And there again is difference in implementation date and technical differences. House Section 23 and Senate Section 22 requires the commissioner to establish payment rates for acute transfers that are based on Medicare methodologies. Again, some technical differences. House Section 24, Senate Section 23 modifies a provision related to rate calculations for out-of-state hospitals. These are identical. House Section 25 and Senate Section 24 eliminate a reference to separate operating and property rates. These sections are identical. House Section 26, Senate Section 25 states that the long-term care hospital shall be paid on a per diem rate established by the commissioner. Again, these are identical sections. House Section 27 and Senate Section 26 modify the references to diagnostic categories to reflect the use of the new APR DRGs. And again, there's a difference in implementation dates and some technical differences.
Mr. Chair and members, House Section 28 and Senate Section 27 require the commissioner to publish state Medicaid waiver requests or state plan amendments to provide an opportunity for public comment and also to publish notice of federal decisions related to these requests. The differences are that the House requires a summary and explanation of the need for the requests in addition to the language of the request, and also that this be placed on the agency website and people being notified through the DHS subscription service. The Senate does not require this summary and explanation and only requires the notice to be placed in the state register. House Section 29, this is a House-only provision. It increases the MA spend-down standard for persons who are aged, blind, or disabled from 75 to 80% of the federal poverty guidelines. Then House Sections 30 through 36 and Senate Sections 49 to 54 from Senate Article 18 make numerous changes to MA coverage for non-emergency medical transportation. And these changes reflect the recommendations of a working group that has studied the issue. Section 30 defines non-emergency medical transportation and allowed providers. It specifies the duties of the local agency and the state in administering the non-emergency medical transportation system. It specifies the different modes of non-emergency medical transportation, and it requires the use of a web-based single administrative structure enrollee assessment tool. Most of the language in this section is identical. The differences are that in paragraph G, the Senate requires payment rates for the different modes of transportation to be budget neutral, and this, the House does not include this language. Then in paragraphs I and paragraph P, there are technical differences. So moving now to page 13 of the comparison summary, House Section 31, Senate Section 50 make a conforming change related to the use of the term non-emergency medical transportation. They're identical. House Section 32, Senate Section 51 modify the meeting requirements for the Non-Emergency Medical Transportation Advisory Committee, modify the issue areas for which recommendations are to be made, and extend the expiration date of the committee from December 1st, 2014 to December 1st, 2019, and the language is identical. Then House Section 33 and Senate Section 52 modifies the membership of this advisory committee. House Section, and they're identical. House Section 34, Senate Section 53 are identical. These sections require the commissioner to implement a single administrative structure and delivery system for non-emergency medical transportation, beginning on the date on which the administrative assessment tool is available, or July 1st of 2016. And it directs the commissioner to develop and authorize this web-based single administrative structure and assessment tool. Then House Section 35, Senate Section 54 are identical. They delay from 2013 to 2015, the year in which the commissioner is to collect, audit, and analyze non-emergency medical transportation performance data. House Section 36 and Senate Section 55 exempt managed care and county-based purchasing plans from various non-emergency medical transportation requirements in the preceding sections, including but not limited to the use of a web-based assessment tool and the collection and reporting of performance data. Then House Section 37 and Senate Section 28 establish a payment procedure for services provided by federally qualified health centers and rural health clinics. There are a number of differences in wording and phrasing throughout the section between the House and Senate, but the same general intent. House Section 38 is a House-only provision in this bill, but similar but not identical language is found in Senate File 2087 and House File 2402, the policy omnibus bills. This requires the Commissioners of Health and Human Services to establish a Healthcare Homes Advisory Committee, specifies membership of the committee and duties, and allows the committee to establish various subcommittees and provides that the committee does not expire. Then House Section 39, Senate Section 30 are related to the hospital payment system changes described earlier. They strike obsolete language related to certified public expenditures and the GAMC program. And there's some technical differences. Then in House Section 40, Senate Section 56 are identical. they increased the MA personal needs allowance to include income garnished for spousal maintenance under a divorce decree. House Section 41 and Senate Section 31 are identical. They narrow the scope of an existing supplemental recovery initiative for third-party liabilities to focus on liabilities identified through the coordination of benefits information. Senate Section 32, this is Senate-only language. This creates a program to provide health coverage to low-income uninsured children effective January 1st, 2016. Subdivision 1 describes eligibility. The children must not be eligible for medical assistance or Minnesota care, must be under the age of 21, and have been determined eligible for the Emergency Medical Assistance Program or certified to have an emergency medical condition. The language also exempts children from the Minnesota Care income limits and from the Minnesota Care citizenship requirements. Subdivision 2 outlines covered services. Covered services are those covered under the current Minnesota Care program. However, services that would otherwise be covered under the Emergency Medical Assistance Program are not covered. In addition, nursing facility services and home and community-based services are covered for certain children. Subdivision 3 provides that the children will pay the applicable Minnesota Care premiums and cost sharing. Subdivision 4 authorizes the commissioner to contract with various entities on a capitated or fixed budget basis, or and can also use gain sharing or risk sharing methods. Then, I guess turning to page 20, House Section 42 and Senate Section 33 both delay the implementation of presumptive eligibility determinations by hospitals from January 1st, 2014. To July 1st, 2014, and the differences of the effective date. The House has an immediate effective date, and the Senate July 1 date. House Section 43 and Senate Section 75 require the Commissioner of Human Services to review the MA spend-down requirements and processes for persons with disabilities and persons who are elderly. The main difference is a different date for the submission of the report, and there are also technical differences. Then House Section 44, this is House only. This prohibits funding for state-sponsored health programs to be used for funding abortions, except to the extent necessary for continued participation in a federal program. House Section 45, this is also House only language, requires the Commissioner of Human Services to study the financial viability of the Minnesota Care program and to report to the legislature. Then House Section 46, Senate Section 79 deal again with the non-emergency medical transportation coverage. It allows new providers to apply to the Commissioner of Human Services for a variance from the Special Transportation Service Operating Standards and provides that the variances expire the earlier of February 1st, 2016, or the date the Commissioner of Transportation begins certifying new providers. Then Senate Section 34 is Senate only. This requires the Commissioner to seek federal authority to make changes to the Emergency Medical Assistance Program to allow coverage and payment for community-based services and outpatient services. Senate Section 35, another Senate-only provision, requires the Commissioner of Human Services to convene a work group to develop a new delivery and reimbursement system for oral health and dental services and to report to the legislature. Then Section 47, House Section 47 and Senate Section 38 are repealers. The repealers in paragraph A relate to the new hospital rebase system, and they're identical except for the effective date. The repealers in paragraph B relate to the non-emergency medical transportation services, and those repealers are identical. And that concludes the healthcare article.
Okay, thank you. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, and I have a question and for the testifiers, and that goes back to page 6 and item 12, and the change to ICD-10, which is, for those that aren't on Health and Human Services, is a huge change in federal law on how you're going to itemize what you're going to get paid for. And the president has just delayed the mandate for that. Is that going to affect what we're going to do, or are we going to have to discuss it? Because I think there's already 10, 15 states that have already shifted to that. And ultimately, we're going to do that. But is there something in the law that now that that's been changed that we would have to do?
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, maybe the department can speak to it, but I believe that it's something that you guys are going to need to discuss, and whether you want to implement it now or, you know, or later.
Nothing made.
Your decision.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, also no change has been made in the language, you know, since hearing about the federal decision to delay. So, you know, again, there might be some opportunity for discussion with the agency.
Just real quickly, and we'll get into the discussion further later on, but my initial conversations with the department and with the Hospital Association is that, you know, because we have a rebasing on the books today that has not been accomplished, we have been trying to get around to rebasing for some time. Most folks are of the mindset that we ought to really continue to focus on getting this rebasing done, doing it once and doing it right. And so the approach that we have in these bills is a pretty good framework that we'd like to keep working from, but it will take more discussion.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Other questions relative to the health article? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Kavanaugh.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Lynn Aves. I work in the research department at the House of Representatives. I'm going to walk you through Article 26, House Article 26, Senate Article 16 on Children and Family Services and North Star Care for Children. I'll be working off of the staff side by side as the other presenters have done. House only sections 1 and 2, found on page 2. Require the Commissioner of Human Services to evaluate different forms and types of child care provided in immigrant communities. On page 2, House Only Section 3 extends an exemption from licensure for certain school-age child care programs. This extension is for 1 year. The next sections involve North Star Care for Children. Those are House Sections 4 to 7, and 13 to 24, Senate Sections 1 to 5, and 11 to 29. These are all governor's proposals. The North Star provisions were adopted in the 2013 legislative session and created consistent payment rates for foster care, adoption, and relative custody care. The provisions in the bill before you make technical changes to comply with federal requirements and also require relative custodians to be licensed for 6 months before their assistance payments can receive federal matching dollars. The Senate language includes budget and policy sections. The House language includes only the budget language. The identical policy language is included in House File 3027, which is currently on the House floor. All of the sections are identical except for two very technical differences. Beginning on page 3 and running to page 5, House Sections 8 to 12 and Senate Sections 6 to 10 allow adult basic education programs, English as a second language activities, and post-secondary education to count as MFIP work activities and job skills training. There are technical differences in terminology and style between the House and the Senate language. On page 9, House Only Section 25 repeals the MFIP family cap effective July 1, 2014. On page 10, House Section 26, Senate Section 30, require the Commissioner of Human Services to make recommendations to the legislature on increasing accessibility to the parent-aware quality rating system for providers and parents. There are technical differences between the House and Senate language. House-only Section 27 requires the Commissioner of Human Services to implement the repeal of the MFIP family cap by July 1, 2014, and if necessary, to use manual procedures to make the changes necessary. House Section 28, Senate Section 31, and House Section 29 and Senate Section 32 are related to the North Star Care for Children provisions. House Section 28 is a reviser instruction regarding the instructing the reviser to change certain terminology, and House Section 29 and Senate Section 32 repeal the special monthly payment for at-risk children and guardianship assistance and adoption assistance. And that is the end of Article 26.
Okay. Questions from the Graves? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Danielle Pinelli. I'm from the House Research Department, and I will be going over House Article 27 and Senate Article 17, the Community First Services and Supports article. As my colleagues have done, I'm going to be going through the House Research and Senate Council side-by-side summary. The Community First Services and Supports program is a new program that was enacted in 2013, and once it's implemented, it will replace the PCA and Consumer Support Grants programs. The language that's contained in this article came from the Governor's Health and Human Services Supplemental Budget Proposal, and it does three things. It gives the Department of Human Services the authority to establish payment rates for consultation and financial management services. It makes changes related to who can work as a direct support worker, and it modifies language to reflect service design and policy decisions related to service standards, service delivery, and program integrity. These changes are required in order to receive federal approval from the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to get federal Medicaid match, and also to implement the program. And there are also changes contained in here that were recommended in a legislatively mandated report related to the implementation of this program. There are really only two sections in this article that have a substantive difference that I'd like to point out. The first section is Section 6, which is on page 3 of the side-by-side summary. The Senate has some additional language in paragraph C that states, upon expiration of the temporary authorization, the participant shall access the consultation service to complete their initial orientation and selection of a service model. And then the second substantive difference is in Section 21, which is on page 8 of the side-by-side summary. And the Senate has an additional paragraph D that provides an exemption to worker training and development requirements for new support workers providing services due to staffing failures. So unless there are any questions about anything else, those are the only two big differences in that article.
Any questions for Ms. Pinelli? Okay, thank you. And Ms. White.
Hi, I'm Joan White in Senate Council, and I will be going over House Article 28 and Senate Article 18 related to continuing care. And Section 1 of the House and Section 1 of the Senate are identical, and they adds data collected under Chapter 245D to the list of data that is considered private data on individuals under the Government Data Practices Act. Section 2 is a House-only provision related to nursing facility level of care. And new Subdivision 11 modifies the nursing facility level of care criteria effective January 1st, 2015. And Subdivision 12 modifies the appeals process for recipients meeting transition population criteria to allow longer period of time to appeal the level of care determination. Section 2 is a Senate-only provision, and it adds a subdivision allowing the Minnesota Department of Health to approve nursing facility moratorium exception projects in which the full annualized state share of MA does not exceed $1 million of this for fiscal year 2015. Section 3 is a Senate-only provision, and it modifies the Board of on Aging Educational Services to councils. Now, the Section 3 of the House and Section 4 of the Senate and a chunk of sections which include House Section 6 through 45 and Senate Section 7 through 46 are the result of the Jensen Settlement, which required the modernization of laws related to aversive and deprivation procedures in licensed facilities that serve persons with developmental disabilities. This is related to the MEDO facility. It's the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options facility in Cambridge and the treatment of the patients in that facility. And as I said, these sections update definitions and update and modernize the provisions related to aversive and deprivation procedures. And most of the sections are identical, and some have technical differences. Section 4 of the House and Section 5 of the Senate amend the corporate adult foster care moratorium, specifically the law relating to the delicensing of beds by adding language to determine how the commissioner will delicense remaining beds. Section 5 of the House and Section 6 of the Senate are identical, amends paragraph E, which establishes timelines for providers licensed under Chapter 245D to execute certain licensing components. And now the next, like I said before, Section 6 through 45 in the House and Section 7 through 46 of the Senate relate to the Jensen Settlement. And update definitions and laws related to Rule 40 procedures. So we can jump all the way following closely to page 12. And that brings us to a House-only provision related to TEFRA, and it limits TEFRA parental fees from January 1st, 2015 through December 31st of 2015. Section 47 of the House and Section 47 of the Senate adds a cross-reference to the Home and Community-Based Services Standards to the DT&H vendor participation and reimbursement provisions. Identical. Section 48 of the House, Section 48 of the Senate requires the Board on Aging to allocate to the area agencies on aging state senior nutrition funds. Section 49 is a House-only provision. It modifies diagnosis requirements under the MA Autism Early Intervention, Early Intensive Intervention Benefit. Section 50 of the House and Article 19, Section 29 of the Senate allows the Commissioner to amend the MA State Plan to achieve the purposes of the MA Autism Benefit. House-only Section 51. Is a rate increase for facilities in Mille Lacs, Isenti, and Kennebec counties. Provides a nursing facility operating payment increase for those facilities effective July 1st of 2015. House-only Section 52 provides a nursing facility operating payment rate in adjustment of 5% beginning July 1st of 2015.
Yep, that's right. right.
House Section 53, Senate stuff. Section 57 are identical, and they add home care providers to the list of providers eligible for home and community-based services, performance improvement, and quality add-on payments. House Section 54, Senate Section 58 are identical. They modify the calculation of home and community-based services quality add-on. House Section 55, Senate Section 59 adds a rate adjustment provided to nursing facilities to the list of external fixed costs used to calculate nursing facility payment rates, and there's technical differences. Senate Section 60 is a Senate-only provision, and it requires, to the extent practical, DHS to designate nursing facilities as critical access facilities evenly throughout the state beginning in fiscal year 2015. And House Section 56, Senate Section 77, provides a rate increase for nursing facilities. The adjustment is based on employees making between $8 and $13 per hour. House Section 57 and Senate Section 61 are identical, and it requires that home and community-based providers meet the requirements of Chapter 245C prior to the revalidation of a license. And now there's another chunk of sections that are Senate-only provisions. And it's Section 62 through 70 and Section 78, and they modify the disability waiver rate system. And what these sections do is clarify, this was actually passed last year, but these changes clarify how rates are calculated, and they define terms that were vague or undefined, and they also require the commissioner to issue a semi-annual report to stakeholders on the rates. And that brings us to page 18.
Mr. Chair and members, on page 18 of the side-by-side summary, House Section 58 and Senate Section 71 are related to the home and community-based settings for people with disabilities. The House language creates an exception to the 25% ratio restriction to provide an exception process to those restrictions for owners, providers, or developers that meet certain requirements. And the Senate bill creates an exception just for one specific project that will be located in Golden Valley. On page 19 of the side-by-side summary, House Section 59 and Senate Section 52 both provide a 5% rate increase for intermediate care facilities for people with developmental disabilities effective July 1st, 2014. The Senate bill requires 80% of the rate increase to go toward direct care staff wages and benefits, and the House bill requires 75% of the increase to go toward staff wages and benefits. The House also requires facilities to submit documentation identifying a quality improvement project to be implemented by June 30th, 2015, and the Senate does not, and then there are other technical and style differences in the language. Senate Section 73 is a Senate-only provision, and it requires DHS to seek federal approval to modify the consumer-directed community supports budget methodology to account for day services for people 21 years old and older graduating from high school between 2013 and 2015. Section 60 is a House-only provision, and this modifies the effective date of the MA Autism Early Intensive Intervention Benefit. This is a new program that hasn't been implemented yet, and DHS needs to get federal approval for it before it can be implemented. Section 74 is a Senate-only provision. It requires DHS to develop a transition plan to comply with Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services requirements regarding home and community-based settings requirements with a report to the legislature due by January 15th, 2015.
Commissioner Showalter is here.
On page 20, House Section 61 and Senate Section 76 provide a 5% reimbursement rate increase for various home and community-based services providers effective July 1st, 2014. The Senate bill requires 80% of the rate increase to go toward direct care staff wages and benefits, and the House bill requires 75% to go toward staff wages and benefits. The House requires providers to submit documentation identifying a quality improvement project to be implemented by June 30th, 2015, and the Senate does not. And the House bill has more providers listed than what is in the Senate language, and then there are other technical and language differences between the two sections. House Section 62 is a House-only provision. It makes available to the Commissioner of Human Services any savings attributable to the delay in the effective date of the MA Autism Early Intensive Intervention Benefit. Senate Section 78 is a Senate-only provision, and this is related to the disability waiver rate system that Ms. White discussed earlier. And then House Section 63 and Senate Section 80 are identical, and this is a reviser's instruction instructing the reviser to change various terms. And then also included in the reviser side-by-side for this article is a separate House bill that's related to veterans housing. So on page 21 of the side-by-side summary are sections 1 and 2 of that House bill, and I don't believe that that bill has passed the Senate yet, so there's nothing to compare to on the Senate side.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you. And perhaps this might be to Ms. White or to Senator Lurie. Given that the House is carrying this delay on the early intensive intervention benefit, and the rationale is because we are unable to implement it because of the federal guidelines, I'm curious then why the Senate wouldn't have it in their provision. Is that the interpretation of the Senate as well?
Is it Senator Lurie?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonhoff, this was a fairly late-breaking item.
Gotcha.
That we weren't really tracking as we were building our spreadsheet. It's one we'll have to take a look at as we move through the...
Thank you.
Yep. We're going to Article, 29?
Mr. Chair and members, again, Jamie Olson from House Research, and I will be going over Article 29, which is the unborn child protection. This is a House-only article. There's no comparable language in the Senate version. The title of this act is the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. It creates a litigation defense fund for the state's attorney general to defend the act should it go to court, and it also adds forms that physicians need to fill out when performing an abortion. Section 4 goes over the definitions used within the Act. Some of the notable definitions include Subdivision 5, which is a medical emergency, and that refers to a condition that complicates the medical condition of a pregnant woman so that it requires an immediate abortion without first determining the post-fertilization age in order to avoid the woman's death or serious risk of substantial and irreversible physical impairment, which does not include psychological or emotional conditions. It also excludes situations based on a claim or diagnosis that the woman will engage in suicide. Other notable definitions include the post-fertilization age, which refers to the age of an unborn child as calculated from the fertilization, and the probable post-fertilization age of the unborn child, which refers to the probable post-fertilization age as determined by the physician in reasonable medical judgment. Section 5 states the legislative findings under the Act, and it says that there is substantial evidence indicating that an unborn child is capable of experiencing pain by 20 weeks after fertilization.
Section 6 requires any physician performing an abortion to first determine a post-fertilization age prior to any abortion being performed or attempted to be performed, with the exception of a medical emergency. Section 7 prohibits any abortion from being performed or attempted to be performed if the post-fertilization age has been determined to be after 20 weeks, and again, that provides an exception for a medical emergency. Subdivision 2 of Section 7 states that if the abortion is not prohibited, that the physician must terminate the pregnancy in a manner which provides for the best opportunity for the unborn child to survive, again, providing for an exception in a medical emergency. Section 8 provides for criminal penalties, which are a felony for any person who intentionally or recklessly performs an abortion in violation of this act. Subdivision 2 provides for two types of civil remedies, provides for damage remedies for the woman upon whom the abortion was attempted or performed, and it also allows for a cause of action for injunctive relief for a variety of people, including the woman upon whom the abortion was performed. Section 9 requires the court to determine whether or not anonymity will be upheld during court proceedings. And Section 10 is a severability clause, which provides that the rest of the act will remain in law if some of the sections are found to be unconstitutional.
Okay. Questions? Right? Mm-hmm. Article 30.
Senator Joan White from Senate Council, and I will be doing House Article 30, the miscellaneous article, which matches up with Senate Article 15, chemical and mental health, and also Article 21, public assistance simplification. And Section 1 is a House-only provision, and it classifies Minnesota Care as a forecast program.
Pardon me?
For 2018 and thereafter.
Careful.
Requires the Commissioner of Management and Budget to reduce transfers from the Health Care Access Fund to the General Fund or to transfer funds from the General Fund to the Health Care Access Fund if necessary to meet annual Minnesota Care expenditures. Sections 1, 2, and 15 are Senate-only provisions that relate to the closure of mental health centers. Section 1 requires counties to prepare a transition plan that provides for the continuity of care in the event a contract with a community health center is terminated. Section 2, Senate only, requires license holders to submit a written plan indicating how the agency will provide for the transfer of clients and records if the agency closes. Section 3 and Section 6 through 10 relate to mental health crisis stabilization services, and these sections increase the accessibility to those services. House Section 2, Senate Section 4, modify the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund methodology to allow the commissioner to seek federal authority to develop a separate payment methodology for chemical dependency treatment services provided by a state-operated vendor, and this is related to the CARE program. It's Community Addiction Recovery Enterprise. Section 5 is a Senate-only provision. It requires the commissioner to pay claims in full and subsequently bill counties for the non-federal share of costs associated with adult mental health targeted case management services for persons who are victims of torture. And again, as explained earlier, Section 6 through 10 relate to increasing access to mental health crisis services.
Usually three.
On to page 5, Senate only, Section 11 adds intensive community rehabilitation services as an MA benefit. Subdivision is effective no later than 120 days after federal approval. House only Section 3 amends a group residential housing chapter of law. It allows the commissioner to enter directly into an agreement with a provider serving veterans eligible for GRH who live in a GRH setting located in Stearns County. House Section 4, Senate Section 12. 12 are identical. It requires GRH rates paid to a facility specified in this subdivision to include adjustments to the rate and any adjustments applicable to supplemental service rates statewide. House Section 5, Senate Rider, relates to civil commitment training. It instructs the Commissioner of Human Services to develop an online training program related to the Civil Commitment Act. The provisions are similar. And House Only, Section 6, requires the Commissioner to report to the legislature on all waiting lists for services and department oversees and directs as part of the background materials for the 2016-2017 biennium. Section 7 of the House and Section 14 of the Senate are similar. They require the Commissioner of Human Services to convene a working group to address issues related to offenders with mental illness who are arrested or subject to arrest. And the working group's main objective is to explore the establishment of a facility that would serve as a hub for offenders with mental illness in the metro area to which the offenders could be transported by law enforcement and assessed. House Section 8 and Senate Article 21 relate to the Simplifying Public Assistance Program eligibility criteria, but the language is very different. The House requires the Commissioner to prepare a draft legislation to implement public assistance uniformity, and the Senate actually changes the statute and implements the public assistance uniformity and simplification. And these changes in statute are in the Senate only Article 21. House Section 9, Senate Section 13. Relate to detoxification services, and they require the Commissioner to develop a plan to include detox services as a covered MA benefit. And then Section 15, as I explained earlier, relates to the closure of community mental health provider facilities, and it requires a report on rate setting methodology for mental health services to assess the current rate setting for several mental health services.
I think those rates were always being
report
studied.
Report by February 1st of 2015 to the legislature.
Okay, thank you. Appropriation forecast sections.
Mr. Chairman, yes, Mr. Albrecht, and I will briefly run through the appropriations article 31 in the House and 14 in the Senate, the forecast article. Because in human services it rolls up to budget activity in the bill, just looking at the numbers doesn't necessarily tell you a great deal without the spreadsheet by it. So I'm going to skip over just numerical differences and differences in riders that are just stylistic and technical in the base riders and just highlight the ones where the language is actually different in the two houses. And working off of the revisers side by side, go to starting on page R2 R3. Well, it starts on R2. On the Senate side, on line 221, you'll see that the Senate has a rider for the training program for the civil commitment process. You'll note on the House side that the House has similar language that is situated differently in the bill. If you jump then to page R4, you'll see at the top of the page there's notations that there is money in there from House File 2556, the language of which is not in here, but is in the state government. Well, is not in this bill at all, but would be in the state government article. The Senate has no comparable language. On the Senate side, on page R5, on line 222.3, is a rider specifying that the Minnesota Care Program for Children's Health low-income uninsured children's health is a general fund forecasted program. Jumping to the bottom of page R5 on line 223.9 on the Senate side is a Senate-only rider for the intensive community rehabilitation program that the House does not have. Jumping to page R6, at the top of the page on the Senate side, you'll see bolded language that shows that this is, again, on the House side, is the rider language for the civil commitment training program. The Senate has the same money. The language is slightly different and is situated differently in the bill. At the bottom of page R6 on the Senate side, you'll see there's a rider related to the Senate's funding of the expert review of the sex offender program ordered by the judge in the Karzgen's case. The House does not have that provision. I'll take you to R8, where we get to the Department of Health riders. I mentioned when we went through the spreadsheet that the House had a number of items grouped under a minority health disparities heading. On page R8 on the House side, well, you'll see first our language on the House's language on the Poison Information Center, which is for enhanced staffing and education and training and surveillance of emerging toxicology issues. Starting on line 420.4 of the House minority health disparity items, there is a header that lists all of the money for the various items, and then on line 420.13, you'll see the House's rider for the dementia outreach grants in minority communities. Moving to the next page on line 420.18, you'll see the rider for the mental health training conference focusing on immigrant and refugee mental health issues. On line 420.27 is the House language on the Somali women-led health care agency grant. Opposite that, the Senate has a different amount for the same program, and it's substantially different language. Moving to page R10 at the top, the House has on line 421.1 a rider that has the undesignated portion of our minority health grants and designates the agency to use for making advanced health equity grants that advance health equity. On line 421.8, the safe harbor language is different between the two houses, but it's stylistic and the money is different. On line 421.16, the House has a rider for the ambulance service for the Leech Lake Band, which helps them upgrade their service to a higher level of licensure. On the Senate side of page R10, at the bottom on line 225.29, you'll see the Senate's rider for the home visiting pilot project for high-risk families. It involves two pilots, actually, evaluating families, high-risk families that are on the Minnesota Family Investment Program. It specifies that one of the pilots must be in the metro area and one must be in greater Minnesota. It directs the commissioner to consult with the commissioners of human services and education and directs the commissioner of health to report back to the chairs and minority leads in the House and Senate Health and Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committees by January 1st of 2016. At the bottom of page R11 on the House side on line 421.34 is the House's rider related to the Healthcare Workforce Commission. Again, this is a legislative commission. It would likely be better situated with an appropriation to the LCC and move to the state government article. Moving to the next page on R12 on the House side is the additional language related to the House's additional work on the spoken language interpreter item. There's you'll recall there's a lower base item that the governor of the House and the Senate all had to just improve the registry. The House has an additional $81,000 allocated to have the commissioner develop a proposal to promote health equity and quality health outcomes through changes to the interpreter program. If you go down, you'll see that this involves qualifications for spoken language interpreters, methods to support their education and skills training, an advisory council, a complaint process, an oversight process, and a catch-all of other issues that may affect quality and access. On the Senate side of page R13 is the Senate's rider related to health care grants for uninsured individuals. There is, I believe, a total of $2 million, but it is specified for a variety of purposes. Dental provider grants starting on line 226.32. On 227.1 is mental health program grants, community mental health program grants. On 227.7 is emergency medical assistance outlier grants that are specified in Article 20 of the Senate's language. And on 227.13 are additional grants for community health center grants. Moving on to page R14 on the Senate side, the Senate rider continues and limits the amount of money that can be used for administrative costs in this program. Going to the bottom of page R14 on the both sides on the healthy housing grants on House lines 423.24 and Senate line 228.1, both have a similar rider related to the basic grants. The Senate goes on to have additional riders for implementation grants and lead poison prevention activities. And on the top of page R15, the Senate has a limitation in that on for that program that no more than one full-time employee be hired. The House has similar language that is situated in Article 24 of the House bill. And that is the differences on the riders. I think Mr. Albright will finish the technical changes.
Mr. Chair and members, on R15 in the middle there is House and Senate provision. This is the first of a number of technical corrections to Chapter 108, which was our omnibus bill from last year. This one, Section 5, clarifies that the transfer provisions in Chapter 1, which was the MA expansion bill last year, there are transfer provisions in there that relate to tracking the actual cost versus the estimated cost of that provision. And if you look on line 424.33 on the House side of R16, you'll see that the stricken language says that those appropriations must become zero. This section clarifies that the transfers would be reduced until they're zero, and then they would stop. They don't just become zero. On the Senate side of R16, Section 6 is a technical provision related to the TANF transfers in the TANF provisions in the Senate's bill. The change that's Section 6 on 425.5 is actually on page R19 at the top. This is the Healthcare Access Fund base rider change. There is a technical difference between the House side and the Senate side. It's on line 232.20. On the Senate side, the Senate has the word only. Mr. Chair, on the next page, page R20, on line 427.25, this section, which goes all the way to page R31, has been enacted as Chapter 156 and doesn't need to be in this bill anymore. So we're now moving on to page R31. Section 8 on line 437.32 deletes an appropriation error in the bill that was statutory appropriation. I'm sorry, it is an appropriation in here to a statutorily appropriated special revenue fund, and so this deletes that appropriation. On the next page, you can see I should say on line 437.34 on R31, changes the amount of the total appropriation. On the next page, on line 438.8, you can see the appropriation being removed. Section 9 on 438.12 is related to the same provision. And if you go to the next page, 438.18, you can again see that appropriation being removed. Near the bottom, line 438.34, this change is actually on the next page, line 440.1. It adds non-cancellation language that was omitted from the final version of this bill. Next change is on page R36. This is similar to the first provision that related to transfers from the Healthcare Access Fund for the MA population. This is actually a section that reduces the Healthcare Access Fund appropriations for the medical assistance program with respect to the estimated and actual amounts for the MA eligibility and enrollment changes that were included in Chapter 108 last year. The next change is on page R37 on the Senate side on line 247.24. The Senate has a dedicated funds report.
And Mr. Chairman, if there are no questions on the appropriations article, the final article of the bill is Article 32 in the House, Article 22 in the Senate. This is the Health and Human Services forecast changes article. And I don't know if it's productive to go through the entire thing or not. You can tell me, Mr. Chair. There are only two differences between the House and the Senate in this entire article.
I think if you can just cite those, that'd be fine.
They are the House worked off the governor's language, which was that listed all the numbers in thousands rather than in ones. And there was also a clerical error in the forecast so that there is one number that is actually different. And the Senate, the House had passed the language prior to our noticing these errors. The Senate corrected those with a floor amendment. Other than that, these articles are identical. And if you would like to finish the day by getting something done, the staff, as House staff, I can tell you, you should adopt the Senate language in its entirety, and then this language, this article will be done.
Maybe you can include a number of other articles in as well, Mr. Byrd.
I only have this one on my radar right now.
Well, that would actually be a pretty good kickoff for we have one other thing to do tonight, but that'd be a pretty good kickoff for our work tomorrow.
Chairman, I'll move adoption of the article, the Senate language.
All right.
And then you'll owe us one because we've just adopted the Senate position. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman? You're agreeing. Okay.
We'll have a chance to correct other House problems as well, so at a later time.
Mr. Chairman, that would be an executive branch problem.
So we have Representative Carlson's motion to adopt Senate position on Article 32. Is there further discussion of that? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries. Thanks for the suggestion, Mr. Berg. So, members, to conclude this evening, we had asked Commissioner Showalter to spend a couple of minutes with us to discuss the position of governor and management budget. I thought I saw him in the back somewhere. Did he?
He was right back there.
He was here.
All right. So much for that. Well, if we're hoping the commissioners, we're hoping the commissioner is just outside somewhere. What we've discussed, Representative Carlson and I have discussed, is tomorrow we'll begin trying to adopt same or similar language. And we've talked to staff beforehand with Don Sullivan and Mr. Marks, Mr. Nauman, Mr. Bodern, about working with their respective staffs to put together where we might be able to do this to get a head start on putting the bill together. So the intent tomorrow would be to, Senator Lurie.
Same and similar with no dollars, correct?
Correct.
Is that, yeah.
And so it'd be our intent to work through that depending on when floor sessions are over. We need some further help. Just some members that have a sense of where we might be going. Obviously, we'll have to involve the administration with trying to take a look at some kind of overall number. The other thing is that, as I think we discussed when we started, there's some significant differences between the House and the Senate relative to some of the one-time money and how that's being tracked in the respective bodies. And some of this intersects with the bonding bill and with some of those discussions. And I think that's fairly unique for the supplemental finance bill to have this kind of intersection. So we need some resolution, not just relative to our own bill, but also how we track some of that, House and Senate, and then finance versus bonding bills. So we'll need some resolution with those numbers and with the placement, and then allow us, depending on how we schedule things, to get some of the work done. So,
Mr. Chairman, there are two that came to mind. One was transportation, and then there was another provision in the tax that involved the tax committee in this one.
Yes. I'm
trying to remember what that article or what that item was, but at any rate, there's those two at least that we have to track in terms of which committee.
Mr. Okay. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Representative Carlson, I don't know if you were talking about a very small provision, which was the North Dakota study is being carried in the tax, but that's so small, I don't know if that's what you were referring to.
I just remember the reference when we were going through
that is being carried in the tax.
Being tracked.
Sorry, so Commissioner Showalter is here, and Commissioner, I mentioned that just wanted to get your perspective, obviously from...
Yeah,
your agency's perspective, but to the extent you might want to speak for the administration in totality, just some thoughts about where we are at this juncture.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. Appreciate the chance to address you and the invitation to come. Really, at this stage, this is a lot of proposals, a lot of work ahead of the committee, and we respect the difficult choices that are ahead of you. Certainly, the governor's recommendations were to have a very limited set of spending recommendations, really honing towards some essential spending recommendations. I hope that the commissioners and the agencies have helped you to understand those, and certainly that is the key part of what we're putting forward, and hope that is part of what ultimately you'll see is part of the final spending package. That said, we know it is a conversation. It is a work that we'll do together. The governor has already started having some framework discussions with legislative leaders. We'll continue to work with them, yourselves, to find ways to make sure that there's enough space address concerns and find a balanced package, because really that's ultimately what he's looking for, is a balanced package of tax reductions, making sure we've got some state stability and some shock absorbers, shall we say, with the reserves, as well as effective limited spending. I think he's already made an offer to increase his spending level by about $100 million. That's sort of about as far as you can go. But the bottom line here is that there's, I think, space here for us to talk about many things. And we look forward to working with you and find ways to accommodate the many different good ideas that are on the table.
And appreciate it, Commissioner. And I think certainly in looking at both the House and the Senate bills, I think there was a lot of respect accorded to be fair, with a couple of exceptions, the governor's what I'll characterize as the governor's deficiency supplemental bill, and I think there's always been an understanding that the House and the Senate would have, we've got 201 of us versus, if you'll allow me, one of you, and so you're going to have a lot of different perspectives coming into play. And appreciate the conversations that the governor has had with Speaker Thiessen and Senator Bach, you know, relative to some of the overall numbers, and I think there's certainly some room to reach agreement. And I recognize that like I said, there are some places I know that the governor and the commissioners have some disagreements. I think there are places that, you know, might be resolved. We've had some significant conversation in the Senate that we established a fairly difficult 16-17 target to achieve, and that's caused, I know, a little bit of angst among some folks. I think there might be some ability to hopefully deal with a couple of those issues as well, and to do so in a way that will be satisfactory to legislative, House, Senate, and executive. Questions for the commissioner that anybody might have? So appreciate your spending a couple of minutes with us. Obviously, I know as we get into more details, we'll have a chance to talk to the individual commissioners about their agency budgets, both in terms of the governor's proposal and how some of what the House and the Senate are presenting might interface with the agencies as well. But appreciate your appearance. So, again, I don't know if anybody else has any concluding comments for tonight. Representative Carlson, you know, we've talked about trying to do this. I thought we'd do this a half hour after session ended. Today we had a Rules Committee meeting in the Senate that had a couple of matters of importance that I needed to attend. But hopefully we can get going at a reasonable hour.
Mr. Chairman, tomorrow. I think we'll stay with that plan if that works